Welcome to the Carpcast. Introducing the two biggest nods that don't use chods. They're old, grumpy, and they're pretty opinionated. Here's your hosts, it's Mark and Jamie.
Hello and welcome to episode 58 of the Carpcast. I'd normally say, how are you doing, Mark? But Mark is loading it. He is in the United States of America with his better half. I don't know if he's going to get any fishing done there, maybe. I think he's going for his wife's birthday. He goes at this time every year, as I always take the mickey for him because he misses one of my favourite times of the year, which is the autumn. I have been fishing this week. I've actually done 7 days. I was lucky enough to go to the Nash Lakes complex down at Kevin's, it's down at his farm in deepest, darkest Essex. Had an interesting trip. I took Roger Bacon down with me. I managed to record a fairly lengthy interview with Roger and Kevin discussing a load of things. One thing that did happen there is a lot of brandy was drunk. And while I don't think Kevin was slurring, I certainly was. In fact, I had a quite traumatic experience. I'm not very good at drinking anymore. Getting old, been on a diet for a few weeks, and certainly haven't touched any alcohol. And even though I was pouring the drinks, I must have got carried away because we drank a litre and a half of brandy. Now, for somebody that doesn't drink spirits, I was told by Kevin and Roger that my head hit the desk that we were, the table that we were on. I had my head in my hands for about an hour. I then went out and threw up in the back of Kevin's back garden. Came back in. They decided to put me to bed. Roger carried me back to my swim. And I fell down a ditch on the way, head first into a bramble bush. So I've got grazed knees, both knees, very sore, grazed elbows, and a very scabby head, being bald and having no hair to protect it. It's a little bit of a mess. Everybody seems to find it quite funny, apart from me. I have not been that drunk since I was a teenager, and I think I've only been that drunk once or twice in my entire life. So I'm going to have to edit the interview slightly because I'm guessing that I'm just rambling towards the end of it. I listened to a quick 5 minutes of the end of it yesterday and I was just like, we cannot broadcast this. But there was definitely some good content in there up until the horrendous drunk bit. So I won't punish you with a drunk Jamie. But we did discuss a load of things. One of the things we discussed was something that was huge on the net last week.
It's on the net. It must be true.
And that was Tom Docherty's capture of the 70-pounder from the Avenue. Carp Talk did us proud again with one of their front pages and headlines. Let's Be Avenue was the caption, as they normally do. They always find something funny, if not subtle. I've had a few myself over the years, been lucky enough to have a few Carp Talk front covers, and they always come up with a pretty good headline. And the sub-headline was Carp Police Out in Force, and that's pretty much sums it up to me. The Carp Police were out. I mean, whether you believe the fish is a record or should be a British record or not, the vitriol and hatred that both Rob Hales, anybody connected to Rob Hales, and Tom himself got was just, it just showed the bad side of carp fishing. It shows how many horrible people there are out there. And even people like Steve Briggs, who's one of the nicest guy in carp fishing, was getting stick. like horrible stick. You know, he made a number of posts about it. He referred to it a couple of times, people like Crowe, and basically anybody that kind of spoke out about it. And I made my feelings quite clear last week. I am going to play out the Rob Hales interview for the facts. I mean, a lot of people will have read the situation now, so it's probably not new news, but it's nice to hear it from Rob himself, you know, about what he's tried to do. Now, I certainly wouldn't call a fish that's been put in the inner lake near or over record size a record. It's not, because it's obviously farmed and manufactured, and this has happened in the trout industry a number of times. I believe the trout actually have two records for the trout. One that kind of records the actual record, you know, the rod and line caught record, and one that actually records, you know, the biggest fish that a trout has been grown to, whether it's artificially, you know, in a fed stock pond. And I don't see any reason why the carp record can't be the same. While I was down at Nashie's this week, I spoke to a number of other people. It's like trade show time of year. All the new Nash products are out there. So I met a lot of their European reps while I was there. Now, to be a European rep for a country like that, you're generally a fairly accomplished angler, you know, somebody who's pretty big in the business in your relevant area. And I spoke to a few chaps. I spoke to Rene, who's a German rep. And I also spoke to another lad who's the Polish rep. Very knowledgeable people, very accomplished anglers. Everybody had heard about it. The whole of Europe's heard about this 70-pound fish. And nobody can really see what the issue is about. I've come to a lot of conclusions over this last week. And one of them is that there are two types of lake. You can never compare catching Captain Jack from Home Fen, you know, somewhere that's had the same stock of fish as the Monument and Avenue and a lot of Rob Hales' lakes. Fish that are fed naturally, you know, they're reared to a decent weight, sold, continue to be reared to a decent weight, and then fished for. That's a commercial fishery, and that's very different to a natural fishery. And that's where I think the line should be drawn. It's very difficult these days. The lines are so blurred. You know, if somebody imports Israeli fish at I don't know, fingerlings, grows them on the stock pond to £35, sells them to a fish supplier, they then continue to grow them on their own stock lakes. And don't forget, most lakes have stock ponds, you know, especially commercial fisheries. I mean, even the likes of Dinton and stuff, which are, you know, some fantastic fisheries. Simon down there has a fantastic fish breeding program. He sells fish commercially, and, you know, he has lakes that he grows fish to over £40 in and then puts them in. You know, albeit English fish, but I don't think you can draw the line at whether the fish, you know, originated in Israel, Croatia, or wherever, because quite often they've taken babies from, you know, that have been born in England from the original Israeli strain or Croatian strain. Don't forget the Lini fish were not English, you know, which are probably the most classic of all fish. They were Dutch, as are pretty much all of them. So I think the line of were they born in England is very sketchy. I mean, if they've lived pretty much their whole life in England, then it's a very murky line, and one you can probably never prove, because a lot of the history fish that we count, you know, as pocker history fish came into this country, you know, doubles from places like Belgium, Holland, Israel, lots and lots of countries. So for me, I think the line should be not drawn at where the fish came from, but is it a commercially fed fish, or has it grown naturally? And I think after all this thinking, is after speaking to a lot of the foreign reps and you know, people who fish for fish in other countries, they don't fish commercial lakes as much as the UK do. Carp fishing's obviously been around, you know, the carp fishing boom has been around a lot longer in the UK. And what you find in Europe is there are a lot less commercial lakes, a lot more natural lakes, and the commercial lakes have quite often taken fish from the natural areas, maybe the rivers or, you know, the huge lakes. Just got to look at, you know, lakes like Lake Balaton, where a lot of the fish have allegedly made their way over from Balaton into Euroaqua. Now, these are the same fish that have then been fed, you know, daily in Euroaqua and have, you know, grown to over 100 pounds, where, you know, the average size of fish in Balaton is nowhere near that. So that's a commercial lake. It should exist. You know, people should be able to pay and go and fish for those fish. But well, from speaking to a lot of the European anglers, like, that they have a very different opinion on commercial lakes and normal lakes. Now, the only difference to me is in England, there are a lot more commercial lakes than there are natural lakes, you know, because that's how a capitalist economy works. There's bigger, you know, there's been a lot more money in fishing. Our carp boom started 20 odd years ago, and it's just kind of the way it's gone. So naturally, there are more people trying to make money out of it, more people purchasing water. But it's no different to a lot of the French lakes. You know, a lot of the French lakes have stocked lakes, but bought fish 30s and 40s, grown them, and people have no problem fishing for them. But in Europe, they tend to see a very big difference, you know, and there's a lot of good European anglers. They won't go near the commercial lakes just because you can catch 70s and 80s. They're not interested, you know, and I've met a lot of European anglers over the last few years, especially this last 12 months and this last summer when I went to Europe. And, you know, every time I hear of a lake that's got a load of 70s and 80s in, and you know, I'll say it's in Croatia, I'll get in touch with, you know, one of the chaps that I met that fishes Croatia a lot. What a chap from Slovenia, Gaspar, in fact, who's a fantastic big fish angler. And I'll mention the lake to him, and he'll be like, no, doesn't interest me, would not fish there. And I was like, yeah, but so-and-so's been fishing there, it's got a load of 70s and 80s in. He went, yep, commercial lake, no chance. And then that's the difference. I mean, the commercial lake should exist, and, you know, people who want to go and hunt out the natural fish and, you know, go and catch them from their original habitat, maybe. But that's where the line should be drawn for records, for credibility. I had a chat with Crowey this week. I met him down at Nash's, and we were discussing this point very briefly. He was actually preparing for an Austrian trip with a few of the lads going out there to work filming. But, you know, one of the things I mentioned is the media to blame in this? Because the media doesn't differentiate between a commercially caught fish and a natural fish. So let's say an angler that goes and spends 5 years hunting, say, a fish like the Burfield Common, you know, quite elusive fish from a big lake with a few obstacles. He might catch that at 56 pound and be on the front cover of Carp Talk, you know, little story about it. Fantastic. Well done to that angler. Then the following week, you've got a chap that's been fishing 3 months. He's booked a session on somewhere like Home Fen. He's caught a 59 pounder, a 60 pounder, a 61 pounder. He then also makes the front cover of Carp Talk, you know, very happy, big smiles. He's caught a 60 pounder. Great. So to somebody that doesn't know any different, which, let's be honest, the elite in carp fishing are actually the minority. They are the smallest percent. Somebody that doesn't know any different, they just look at that and they go, oh, you know, so-and-so has caught a 61-pounder, and last week somebody caught a 56-pounder. Now, there's no differentiation in merit or... And carp fishing isn't a competition. It's, I'm sure the guy that caught the Burfield Common was super happy, and the guy that's caught the 60 from Home Fen super happy. I don't know why people get upset in the meantime. And maybe the magazines are to blame. Maybe because, you know, magazines like Carp Talk don't differentiate between you know, the merit of capture. But how do you rate? You know, this fish is difficult, and everything that's caught from here is a, you know, it should be rated really highly, and everything's caught from this lake shouldn't be. So for me, the differentiation is commercial and non-commercial, and maybe the records could go the same way. I'd actually vote for a scrap of the record. I it's pointless. I mean, the elite carp anglers, the people that are just hunting these, you know, air quotes, special fish, quite often they say they don't care about the weight. Anyway, I just wanted to catch the Burfield Comet. It doesn't really matter what weight it was, if it's 49 or 59, it doesn't matter. So, but they seem to be the people that are bothered about records. You know, they seem to be the people that are, oh no, you know, Richard Walker's 44 pound, Chris Yates is this pound, you know, Oz Holness when he caught it, so and so. They're the ones that the record probably matters least to, so let's just get rid of the record. It doesn't matter. Fishing is personal, you know, and who, as I said last week, who has the right to say what one person should enjoy when in their hobby and pastime? Fishing is not a competition unless you're actually match fishing. So let's play out the Rob Hales interview, and at least we can have the facts from the horse's mouth about exactly what happened with that fish.
I've been talking that much today, I've nearly lost my voice, so I do apologise.
I'm not surprised. Well, if you've got a few more minutes to talk to me, as Ian probably told you, you know, I'm not here to throw you under the bus or anything, or generally interested in yourself and, okay, you know, what you've achieved with the lakes. I mean, what I know about the lakes so far, obviously, that both Acton Lakes have had a great reputation for a lot of years. You know, I remember when it used to appear on the front cover of Carp Talk, the biggest brace, if somebody, you know, you had the biggest brace on us a couple of times, didn't you? I think
Pete Holdout, I think, yeah, I remember that,
he's a Blackpool guy, which is where I'm from. I know Pete. Alan Taylor had a big brace, didn't he, as well, at one point?
Alan had the same two fish that Pete had.
Yeah, I know Alan from back in the day as well. Done a lot of European fishing. So, I mean, it's always... I know the area, I know Shropshire. It's absolutely stunning. I've seen the pictures of all your lakes. They're all stunning looking. You've had these fish. I mean, what's been your philosophy on what you've tried to do there? I mean, it seems like you've always gone down the very large fish route. You tell us a bit about sort of, you know, your thoughts on it all, how you've got to this point of producing a British record.
I must admit, I'm a little bit surprised as to how shocked people are, because I would have done it and succeeded a number of years ago, but I had a very special fish that grew very fast to low 50s, and then I lost her when I went away on a trip. I had a power cut on my fish farm and I lost that fish. Otherwise, I probably would have done it a lot longer ago than now. But the fishery here was created with... I've got day ticket fisheries and syndicate fisheries, as you know, and I wanted a fishery where I got a really sick chance of breaking the British record. So I created this fishery at my home. It's 10 and a half acres. And the idea was to get the very, very best individual fish we could, you know, and grow them to the best of their ability and keep the biomass well within its capacity, subsidise the fishery with feed myself, so not rely on the anglers because they're never putting the bait in. So subsidise the food so the fish were always getting sufficient food, makes them harder to catch, but obviously maximises the growth and keeps them in pristine condition, and see how big we could get them. And we got a mirror to 61.8, which Ian caught, was the first one to catch it at 40. It went to 61.8. Ian Russell had it at 57. That fish sadly died around spawning time. It was caught at the wrong time. I think it was just stress that killed the fish.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, that was probably a bigger fish then than the big girl is now, because it's gone over the British record. The scales... One set has gone off to Reuben Eaton to be verified. The other set have been verified this afternoon. So we'll know for sure what the weight was by the end of the day. And that's been it, really. And, you know, I'm always paying top money for the best fish, whether it be one, two, or three fish. I don't mind, you know, travelling to get them. These fish were bought, three or five fish I had from a good supplier who's imported the fish legally, you know, they're all bought above board. And I think this particular fish was £39 when I bought it. I only ever weighed it twice during its all the time I was growing it. I weighed it at 42, and then in March of this year I weighed it at 58.
Wow. So how long have you had this fish then?
Just under 3 years, I think.
Wow, that's some growth rate. I mean,
but it's not been in a fishery, you see.
Yeah, it's just been left to feed when it wants. You fed it. Yeah. So is it in a stock pond? Is the pond like? Is it?
No, it was in a large reservoir, which we've always used as a growing on board. But since we opened it as a fishery called the Little Avenue,
right?
I always grew lots of fish in there. All the Monument 2 fish were grown in there. There's all big automatic feeders on it that float around on the top and follow the fish. So if the wind moves, the fish move, the feeders follow the fish.
Right.
It's quite cleverly done. And then when we opened it as a fishery, there was a few that I'd bought that I thought were just too good. So I put them to one side and I grew them and took them out of the fishery with a view to seeing how they'd do. Now, this particular fish and two others, three females, were taken out and put in my fish farm, which is a man-made fish farm.
Mm.
And the pools are only small, clay-lined. And it was spawned with a male fish out the avenue. So I've got thousands and thousands of her babies as well now.
Wow.
And I checked them to see how much they reconditioned after spawning. So I thought, well, I'm not expecting to be any bigger, really, let alone to have reconditioned. And I was just blown away. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, since March, she's put on all that weight. Having spawned in May, so it's quite remarkable, really. So it's just an incredible fish. I had another 36 that only got to 42.12, you know, same strain, same batch. Another one that was 31 that got to 35, same strain, same batch. And they all went in together, all three went in. And she's the only one of them to have been caught so far. So she's obviously just particularly special, as well as being genetically a very good fish.
It's just one of those flyers, just one of them ones it's interesting that you had some, you know, were they similar weights as well, the other ones that you handpicked?
Yeah, from memory, I think the biggest one was 39, and I'm sure that, because I've rung him, it's the biggest one he ever sold me. And I think I had quite a few, 33 to sort of 37, and they'd have been two of those. You know, some went on to Monument 2. One of the best ones is still in the Little Avenue, yet to be caught. That's a beautiful fish, which we videoed recently, but it's only open in September, so that fish hasn't been caught yet. But these particular ones, you know, the others only put on, 4 pound, 5 pound max. You know, in being given the same treatment in the same pool, that fish has put on monstrous amounts of weight.
Wow. I mean, I don't know if you're surprised about the sort of blow up on the internet. I've seen everything. People have been saying it, you know, it's been imported from abroad last week and dropped in the lake at 74. I've heard all sorts this week. It's quite disgusting. I mean, I know Tom, who's caught the fish, he came on one of our first Carpcast socials. He's an absolutely lovely fella. And then we spoke to him yesterday on the phone. He went, I cast out and I caught a fish. That's it. I went fishing and caught a carp. So the sort of hate that I've read towards him is disgusting.
It is, because that's the thing that I almost regret. You know, I don't care what any of them say, to be honest, and I don't go on social media much, but everybody tells me all about it and the CERN and everything. But if they were detrimental to him, it is disgusting, because he's the nicest kid in the world, and he's just caught the fish. You know, it's simple as that. You know, in 3 or 4 years or 5 years, it'll probably be beaten and nobody will bat an eyelid, but it's nothing. He's done nothing at all. I mean, that's very sad, really, if that's the case.
And you know, a lot of people are saying it's, you know, this instant big carp fishing, and you know, it's pure money. And you know, I happen to know, and I hope you don't mind me saying, you're not poor, you're not short of a bob or two, are you? You know, I've seen the properties that you have, and it can't just be about money, because you already have an extremely successful sort of complex of lakes with big fishing, numerous day ticket lakes that are quite exclusive.
I made my money. I mean, this might sound a bit blasé, but I don't mean it to sound like this. But as you say, I made my money in the toy industry in a company which I still co-own.
Yeah.
The fishing is, you know, it's just about living in comparison. You know, I wouldn't live where I live and the life I live out of fishing, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a hobby. And that's all it is. I retired when I was 40 years of age from a successful company. I had a lot of luck in business. So this is just a hobby. One of my boys works with me, and the other one's enthusiastic about what we do. So we started a fish farm, and we're selling our fish, and we enjoy that. So we're going to be selling the spawn and the babies of this fish in 2 years' time, whatever way. I mean, I don't make a lot of money out of fishing, far from it.
This is the interesting, is you're saying that this particular fish, the flyer, has bred in one of your ponds. You have its offspring. Yeah. You have these fish that are, you know, completely about as English as you can get, born in this country, and they're presumably going to be fed in extremely, you know, healthy conditions for carp. And you potentially, you know, hopefully in your lifetime will grow another record fish that has lived its entire life in the UK. And I mean, it makes a mockery of you know, that some of the things that you see and read. It's, you know, I'm gonna catch it on garlic on French bread. It's like, well, first of all, you don't have the facts. It's not a French fish anyway. I believe it's Fenland Fisheries, isn't it, that that supply.
I don't want that to be common knowledge, because the problem I have is that when I started cherry picking the best fish, it was no big deal, and they need to be quarantined quite strictly, and other people who go there naive and buy them and think they can do what I do could come hugely unstuck.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the truth. And also, you know, the problem is now there's more people out there want them, think they can do it, and there's more people bidding against me, and not so much the financial side of it, but I might miss out on the one I want. You with me? Because I'm not after 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 fish. I'd rather pay a lot more for what I think is the special one.
Yeah, well, you've certainly picked this one well. I mean, what is that the sort of size you generally buy fish at? You said that was the biggest one you'd bought. I mean,
the biggest I could get them, and the biggest, I think the biggest he's ever sold me is 39 ounces. I think the biggest he's ever had is a 42, which I didn't get.
Yeah.
I basically would buy, if the fish was perfect and it looked like it got massive potential, I'd buy the biggest fish I could.
Right.
Yeah. Right. And I mean, I'm 51 years of age. I'm trying to cut corners as much as I can, because you talk about the biggest fish we've got in the avenue that was spawned from our own fish would probably be about 47 now and growing very fast. The father of these fry was a 25 male out the avenue that was growing exceptionally well. So that's a fish I've spawned. So the father to these fish is a spawned fish, and we haven't yet got our first homegrown 50 that we've spawned ourselves, but we've got them in upper 40s.
It seems to be working what you're doing as far as growing the fish. I mean, you're just trying to make the best fishery you possibly can with the best fish. It sounds like these fish have vigorously health checked when you get them.
I quarantine them for over a year on my own. I don't take any chance. Every individual fish. Wow. You know, the people are going out there buying. I can only say to them, if they don't do that, they'll come unstuck. They're not compatible with lots of fish, those fish aren't.
Right.
You know, they've got to be careful. So I quarantine the fish for 12 months on its own with a one or two guinea pigs.
Yeah,
I always do that.
Just fish from other sources and see how they get on with them, sort of thing.
Yeah, my guys know, my fish farm's on the side of the fishery, my reservoir's 200 yards across the field. My syndicate members know everything. They know I've had these fish for a long time. My son even named the fish Big Rig, and he's stuck. So we've talked to them about Big Rig for a long, 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 long time, you know.
Yeah.
But of course they think, oh, yeah, you know, and I'll believe it when I see it. You know, there's always that mentality in fishing, but the people who know me know that it's all factual, and I tell them to the best of my knowledge what I think, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not a surprise to a lot of the members.
No. Ian mentioned, had you already always intended to put these fish in the avenue sort of now, or would he mentioned something about you going to Euro Accra and maybe having to move the fish earlier than you wanted to?
What happened was, when I was 50, I organised a 50th trip to Villadon. Right. In France, and all the lads stayed in the cabin that's between the fish farm and the fishery, and it's on the same power supply. One of the guys must have put a toaster or a kettle or something on and tripped my power. Now, I've got obviously quite a lot of fish in the pools with some of the fish, so you know, I might have 129-pound fish in one pool, for example, and it's 3/4 of an acre, but I've got a sophisticated air system on it, as well as surface aerators that run 6 hours a day as well.
Yeah.
So basically, I'm sitting down there on the Wednesday thinking, oh, I better tell the boys to check it, because I'd never had a problem. So it wasn't something I was expecting. and I groaned a fish that was probably, I don't know, a low 30, up to 62 pound in a couple of years, and this fish was a really special fish. And when I rang the guy, the auction had crashed. The stock intensity was too high. The auction had depleted massively. I lost that fish.
Right.
So what happened this time was, it was like, it was unbelievable how chain of events that happened. I was 3 or 4 days before I'm due to go to Urawaka with Briggsy. I walk around the fish farm, I top all the feeders up, go back down on the evening, and I'd set the timer wrong. So instead of feeding 6 times a day over 2 weeks, the feeder, which holds 100 kilos of feed, had gone the entire lot in one go. So I thought all I was intending to do was move them from one fish farm to pool to the other, where I got a low in stocking density and the auction was fine, I hadn't got such an issue, and the ammonia was absolutely fine. But when I got them out, it was like they were in full-on winter condition. They were just unbelievable condition. So I thought, well, I was going to move them in November anyway, sod it. So I just put them straight in the fishery.
Right, yeah.
And I told the syndicate I wasn't going to move the fish till the winter, because, you know, you don't. I wouldn't have done. I've never moved fish at this time of year in my life. But they're all on the same site permit, so I can move fish from one to the other without, you know, with, yeah, absolutely fine.
Yeah.
So I just put them in because they just looked amazing. They'd gone beyond my expectations in terms of condition, and two of them had done well, and one of them had just gone, you know, phenomenal.
Did you have any idea it was £70 until that point when you took it out?
If I'm honest, I weighed it. What the guys go, oh, weigh, and I said, no. I said, this fish is over £60 as I held her. And angling times are driving me mad now for the pictures of when I bought her and now, but I think it'll take away a bit of the capture from Tom, so I'm sitting on the fence as to whether to send them or not. But a couple of the guys said to me, come on, let's weigh her very quickly. And when we actually weighed her at the time, it was very crudely holding scales on the side, and it could have been a bit of water in the sling, and was she off the, you know, it was all that. It was a bit of a rush because I just wanted, the water temperature was so warm, I'd got to get that fish into the fishery quick.
Yeah.
But at the time I weighed her, I actually thought she was even bigger.
Wow.
I was expecting her to come out. I actually think she's gone in there and lost a couple of pounds.
Yeah.
And then she's settled down, and after 3 or 4 weeks she's gone on the feed, and I wouldn't be surprised if that's the first time she's gone on the feed heavily and she's got caught, because I don't know for sure, she wasn't weighed accurately, but I thought she was slightly bigger than that, if I'm honest.
Yeah, they do tend to lose a bit until they settle down when you move fish. I'm sure you've seen that lots of times, haven't you?
Yeah, well, you know examples. I mean, I know a guy, they bought a 27 and he got it to 57 in 4.5 years.
Wow.
That was the fish in Rosemere. That's now in Rosemere.
Yeah.
Now that fish hasn't gone past 57 to this day, ever since it's been angled for.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yet it was growing at a rapid rate of knots before it went in the fishery.
Yeah. It's very different once they know they're being fished for, I think.
Yeah. I mean, she may not go on. She may settle and go on. It's hard to tell. But, I mean, we haven't got many fish in the fishery that aren't continuing to grow. I mean, we've got a huge head of 40s in there, and we've got 550s, and we've got a common very close to 60. So there's a lot of fish in there, and they're great. They're all going very quickly, but you're absolutely right. This fish might come out next time at 65 and never get back to that weight, but I wouldn't be surprised either way if it suddenly came out at 74.
It sounds like this one's a bit special, this particular fish, from what you've said. It's something genetically different about it to the others.
Yeah, but if you look at you're absolutely right, but if you look at the fish in this country, wherever they're from, the handful of monsters are freaks, you know, they're just, you know, there's loads of fish in, if you look at all the record fisheries, you know, they've all got loads of other fish in them, but there's the standout fish in nearly every one, isn't there?
Yeah.
You know, if you're lucky, you might have a standout two fish, but there's not two parrots in Wasing, there wasn't two tones in Conningbrook.
No.
You know what I mean? They're individual fish, aren't they?
That's right. It's always a flyer. You know, I've spoke with many knowledgeable people about this, and you know, when you get a batch of fish, you'll have a group that never grow, you'll have a group that stay in the middle, you'll have the better than average, and then there's always a flyer. If you're lucky, you get two, but generally there's one flyer, you know. And quite often, I mean, when that one dies, another one takes over as well. It's like there's a pecking order.
Yeah, it is quite remarkable. One won't grow for years, and the big fish will die, and the next one moves through. That's absolutely right. And also, you look at, suppose one of the exceptions to the rule is up in Willows, where they've got some spectacular Croatian fish, and they've got four or five of them in a day ticket have grown over 50, which is quite remarkable. I mean, you know, if I'd had those fish and done what I've done, they would probably all have been British record fish by now.
Yeah, that's a crazy lake, that one. Like you say, there's five, maybe even six different 50s now, and two 57 pluses. I mean, that is unreal, considering it's not fed. I mean, you're making, it sounds like you're trying to make the most ideal conditions you can possibly make, you know, from the oxygen levels to feeding them, you know, and not having them stressed, feeding them while they're not being angled for. I mean, that's what Kevin Nash tried to do with his lakes as well. I mean, he believes he grew a good 70, which sadly never got caught out of way. But that I know from speaking to Kevin, that was his goal. He wanted to try and grow a record, just like you did, I think. Yeah. You've obviously succeeded in doing it. And I'm sure it's not your last. Is there any 80-pounders swimming about in one of the stock ponds?
Well, I feel like now I've created a bit of a monster, and also the fishery now is so spoiled with big fish that I sort of have a goal, and if I'm lucky enough to achieve it, I'll go on to something else. And I feel like now my attention is going to turn back to the monument, where, because not everybody can fish the avenue, it's going to be tricky to get in. So there's a lot of, yeah, but I can't fish for it, so it doesn't interest me, which I fully understand. So, you know, we've got fish to 49 in the monument over the years. We've never got a 50. That fish has passed away, so our biggest fish is probably mid-40 now. So I'm going to grow. I've still got some nice fish, and I've got some more fish on order for November. And I'm hoping now the publicity will give me the cream of the crop again. And then I'm going to grow these fish on for the monument. So I'm not going to wait for them to get that sort of size. I may not even have a fish that'll do it. But once I get to the 50-pound bracket, I'm going to stock them in the monument so that they're accessible to everybody on the day ticket.
Yeah, that's
So that's my next little project, really.
Well, it sounds like you're doing it very well. I know it's a beautiful complex up there. You know, the lakes are all fantastic. I think I'm booked on with Briggsy and is it Jack Meehan or is it Paul? Doing the trips in the spring. So I hope to meet you. Hope to meet you then if you're around on that week that we're there.
Yeah. You're part of Acton, are you?
Yeah, we're fishing the Acton Lake.
Yeah.
One, I think.
Yeah, lovely, yeah. So, I'll be up there. I'll be up there, and we're putting some young fish in, more young fish in Acton Lower Lake for the future, because we've got a situation there where, you know, a lot of the big fish are getting old, and, you know, they're angled for a lot. They're spectacular, lovely old dart fish, but they are what they are. They're old, so we've got to start thinking about restocking there. The syndicate never like it, but, you know, it's something that's got to be done. But, yeah, if you've never been to Acton, it's absolutely spectacular.
So I've heard, and I've seen many pictures over the years, so I look forward to it, and thanks for talking to us, Rob.
No, it's a pleasure. Hopefully I'll meet you then.
So there we have it, from the horse's mouth. Like it or not, I know there's a hell of a lot of purists that are not going to agree with what Rob's doing down there, but, you know, that's life, that's business. There are commercial fisheries, and there's been lots of them about for a lot of years. It's just that Rob seems to have done it better than anybody else. Like I say, you don't have to fish for him. It's not compulsory. And the people that do want to fish for him, fine. You know, off you go. I've caught some of the toughest fish in the country, and, you know, I've spent years living in bushes and, you know, being obsessed by carp. And sometimes I just want to go fishing with my mates and catch some big fish. You know, maybe not quite so difficult, maybe just for fun. And anybody that says I shouldn't be able to do that is the one with the problem, not me. And but, you know, as I've said many times, do I consider that the same as when maybe I've caught, you know, a really tough fish from a low stock water? Of course I don't. The achievement level's different, and a personal best is exactly that. It's a personal best. It's the fish that you count as your biggest achievement. It might not be the biggest fish that you've ever caught. You know, if I happen to go on a lake such as Home Fen or something like that and catch the big one, would I consider that more of an achievement than the 60 nights I fished trying to catch the fat lady, or, you know, the season I fished trying to catch my first 40 when I did 25 blank nights before my first bite? You know, which is the bigger achievement to me? Well, that's what I consider the biggest achievement. It doesn't make any difference. You know, and the other type of fishing, the commercial fishing, I consider fun. I consider it almost like being on holiday, just the same as when I go to France or somewhere like that. You know, I have not put many large commercial or foreign fish in the press in my entire life, and that's just because I have my own morals and boundaries of not credible, because that's the wrong word, but of what I consider an achievement to me. And some people will never fish a commercial water in their life. Fine, crack on doing what you're doing. But as long as nobody's breaking laws, you know, nobody's illegally importing fish, and nobody's risking existing stocks. It sounds like Rob's very careful with his stocking policies. He says he quarantines the fish for a long time, and he's aware that the particular Israeli fish, while they grow big, they don't mix well with other fish. So he's aware of that, and he seemed quite keen to let other people know that it's not just as easy as going and paying a ton of money and buying some big fish and growing them on. You know, you've still kind of got to know what you're doing. And he seems to, like him or loathe him, he seems to. And seems like a nice chap. It looks like I'm going to meet him next year on a trip that I'm doing. So yeah, there we go. That's enough. We're not going to speak about the £70 fish again, I don't think. I think that's pretty much all I've got to say on the matter. Personal bests are personal bests. It's what it means to you. And, you know, and fish caught from commercial fisheries shouldn't be classed the same as fish caught from natural lakes. And if you've got a bitter opinion about somebody that chooses to enjoy their hobby in the way that they enjoy it, then you're everything that's wrong with carp fishing, not them. So that's my that's the end of it. Moving on, something we mentioned on the Lee Jackson podcast, which was two or three podcasts ago, right at the end of it, I foolishly said that I would help them out with the carp super band that they're going to do. Well, my bluff has been called, because Lee rang me yesterday with details of a gig at the Circus Tavern after, I think it's the weekend of the Sandown show, the Carp Society show later in the year, and I've been roped in for a half an hour set. Now, I haven't picked up a guitar in 15 years. Yes, close to 15 years. Now, I was somebody, I have a collection of guitars, like Ovation Acoustics, Washburn Lee guitars. I've got a Fender Strat Plus. I used to play a lot of guitar. I would practice 4 to 5 hours minimum a day. You know, sat there with a metronome, practicing scales, doing finger exercises. And, you know, I probably averaged 7 to 10 hours a day for at least 10 to 15 years of my life. It was a big part of my life. I made my living from playing the guitar in bands, and I owned a band that used to tour around Europe. Now, I haven't played for such a long time. I'm actually a bit scared. But we'll give you details of the gig if anybody does want to go, or anybody's already attending the Sandown show and they're in the area. Then the gig's going to be at the Circus Tavern, and we'll be playing a few rock songs. I mean, I haven't even listened to rock music for a lot of years, but I'm going to have to start practicing. While I was fishing with Roger this week, he said to me, you take on too many things, and he's probably right. I do. and I might live to regret this one, so I'm going to have to get the axe out again and start those finger exercises, see if my old age arthritis has held me back from whittling solos. But yeah, Lee sent me a song list through, and as long as I don't have to sing it, it shouldn't be too offensive. But yeah, I'm kind of regretting doing that. DNA Baits, I'd like to talk about DNA. DNA have sponsored us since the very start, and and they're kind enough to offer a discount to all of our listeners on any of their excellent products. I will tell you shortly, but Roger's been on Nashie's Cops Lake with me this week, and he's had two of the A team. He had three fish, including two of the A team, on DNA baits. He's had it on the S7, which he swears by. A friend of mine, Jason Walker, as well, has also had a mega season on Dinton White Swan, including catching the twin. the week before last, he uses the S7 as well, and it is a bait that a lot of people seem to really like. And you can get a discount off all their Pulse3 package deals using the code CARPCAST5 at the checkout. You can check out all their products at dnabaits.com. They do like fluoro pop-ups, Pulse3 package deals, their candy sticks, the wafters. They do 5 key boilie deals where you get the boilie and a pot of hook baits for £45. They do a 10 kilo one where you get the same for £80. They do a second version of the same where you get the boilies, the hook baits, and a litre of your choice of liquid. They even do 50k boilie deals where you can order 50 kilos of freezer baits split into a couple of different sizes. You get the wafters, the pop-ups, a litre of hydro wheat or beta stim. That was £320, and as I said, you get an extra discount off that if you use the code CARPCAST5 when you check out, and you'll get an extra 5% discount off everything at dnabait.com. And thank you to them for supporting us. I'd also like to tell you about a brand new venture that I have, starting a holiday booking company for fishing holidays. And we're looking at fishing holidays with a difference, not the sort of usual drive and survive lakes that are available, on many, many booking sites where you just literally pay your money and turn up. I'm looking to work with a number of individual people that have got something a little bit different or a little bit special. And I have the first business up, which is fishing on the River Lot in the southwest of France. The property is owned by an extremely accomplished angler, Jim Lightfoot, who has bought himself a villa on the River Lot with private fishing space. And I've working closely with Jim to make some really nice holidays. Now, this villa is aimed at families with anglers and kids. I mean, you can take a group of anglers and without your family if you would like, if you've ever fancied fishing the River Lot for the fantastic fish that there is on offer. But the villa, it's got its own pool in the back. It's decent weather all year round, so you can fish this in the winter as well as the summer. It never gets very cold in the southwest of France that time of year. But in the villa, there's 3 bedrooms. It sleeps 6, plus there is a sofa bed as well if you wanted to squeeze more in. There's legal night fishing on private land. Your boats and outboards are provided. It's very family orientated. There's even push bikes and stuff to go and visit a local area or mooch up and down the river. There is an airport nearby as well if you didn't want to drive, if you wanted to fly in, and transport can be arranged, pickups, and you can also hire tackle there if you really do want to fly and not take any kit. Then you can hire the equipment once you're there, including having a pickup service from the airport. You can drive it from Calais. It's about 7 hours, I think, from Calais to get that far down. It's a non-flood area, so you're pretty safe if you book any time of the year. It's the river is not going to be in flood. And what a different way to fish in France, you know, to fish the very well-known River Lot. The trips run Saturday to Saturday, and they start at £1,000 per week for a villa that sleeps 6 or 8 people, including the fishing, the boats and the outboards and stuff. I think that's a really good price. It rises to £1,350 for a week in peak time in July and August. And it's a very touristy area as well. It's not just all about the fishing. Jim's also got a 2-berth boat down there as well, which you can actually fish, you know, not as a separate holiday. You can just hire the boat if you're an experienced captain or you feel you can handle a boat on the river, or you can just book it for yourself and have Jim guide you all the way down there. That's absolutely separate, but you can find out more information about all this from a website that I've set up now, which is vipcarpholidays.com. That's www.vipcarpholidays.com. And I'm going to be adding 3 or 4 other people with similar type properties or lakes, something that's a little bit different. And if you've got a lake that maybe you've owned it recently, it could be in any country, it doesn't have to be France, but somewhere abroad, somewhere people go on holiday, and you think it's a little bit different, it's sort of a bespoke property or lake and you would like me to sell it for you, then by all means get in touch with Jamie Klosick on Facebook, or go to VIP Carp Holidays, make an inquiry through there. If you've got something that you think fits this bill and you would like me to promote it for you, to put it on the map, then I'm happy to speak to people about adding extra properties to this. But have a look at the river lot. It's absolute paradise down there. The villa looks stunning, and it's perfect to take the family. You know, it's in a nice little French town. And there's loads of ways to do this holiday. So yeah, check out the new website. It's up and running. The river lot details are on there, but it is work in progress because we've literally just launched this. But so please bear with us if the website is not quite as detailed as it's going to be over the next few weeks. I've got Reese working very hard on it. But yeah, get yourself to www.vipcarpholidays.com and you can pay deposits, have a look, go and see all the pictures and just check out what's on offer there. We can sell this from straight away. I mean, the weather's still warm in the south of France all year round, and you can book holiday for either this winter if you wanted, or anytime next year, or straight away. So check it out, vipcarpholidays.com. And if you'd like to add your property to that website, then please do get in touch with me. This next interview is probably going to be quite embarrassing. I'm going to have to get the editing button out fairly seriously, I think. As I said, I was drunk, but had the pleasure of being down at Nash. We checked out all the new products for next year, which I recorded a walk round in the showroom, and they've got some fantastic new products. One thing I really like the look of is the inflatable hooking mat, which I think is going to be the standard for all unhooking mats going forward, because they're a fantastic idea. But in the meantime, I had the pleasure talking to Roger, who is a very requested guest on our show. And Kevin, and we chew the fat and have a few drinks. So hopefully it's not too painful. You will know very shortly. But yeah, we're welcoming the guys. Feels like I'm in love. Just had the first time I met you. Right, okay, well, let's start this officially now. The mic's recording. It's been a while since we spoke. It's been a few weeks, Kev, and something major's happened during that time. I know you don't want to get too deep into politics, but a £70 carp caught by an ordinary guy, an ordinary angler, has received all sorts of threats, death threats, and all sorts of hideous stuff has been said to him. Social media has came alive like I've never seen it before, and I mean never seen it. It was like, you know, the final of X Factor. Every single post was about a £70 fish with no other posts in between. Firstly, what do you think? Should it be a record, number one? And I probably know that answer, knowing you personally, but what's your views generally on it's brought out the ugliness of the fishing scene, of the carp fishing scene. I think it's shown carp fishing in a bad light, or the people that go carp fishing. I think it's kind of it reminded me of the Brexit arguments on Facebook, to be honest, because it brought out the worst and the best in people. But it showed a lot of negatives to me. What's your general overview on the subject?
It's probably the most lacklustre response you ever had from anyone, Jamie. I don't know what's been going on, but I think that sums it up. The older I've got, the less I want to get involved in carp fishing politics, and the more I think to myself, it's only carp fishing, what the hell? You know, people just get so wound up about it, you know, probably because they've got nothing better to do in life. Yeah, you know, it's only carp fishing. Should it be accepted as a record? Record for what? Yeah, I don't care, you know.
I'm interested in what you say is because this could have been you. You could have been the guy getting the flak now that Rob Hales is getting. Now, I'm not saying the situations are the same, because yours are English thoroughbred carp bought from Broadoak. Was it your original biggins that went in the church and the cops? But they were fed for a number of years, and you grew a fish probably bigger than this fish has been caught at. So I ask you, because this could have been you getting the death threats and the horrible stuff said on the internet. Now, I know it would have been water off a duck's back, but it could be you right in the middle of this. Probably the biggest thing I've ever seen in angling in 30 years.
Well, it would never have been me, because of the great respect to Rob. I wouldn't fish his waters because they're foreign fish, in my opinion. Certainly the early ones were. I think there's enough evidence of that, so I've heard. I'm not going to slander myself here, alive, whatever the word is, but whether they are or not, there's a question mark. And personally, I don't want to fish for certain classifications of fish, shall we say. And I'll use that word again, personally, because the one thing in all this, you know, from what I'm understanding, the poor bloke who caught it may dread the day he ever fished that place. He might be, he never knew it was in there.
That's exactly it, right. Nobody did.
So I feel so sorry for me if I'd caught it and then found out the circumstances of it, you know, but that is just me. I think carp fishing is a very personal thing, and the one view I've held for years is that no other individual should judge you over what you want to fish for, whether it be a foreign 70 or an English 10 pound wildie. You know, I think fishing is very, very personal, and it's what it means to you. And I've got my certain standards, and I'm not suggesting foreign fish are that standard, but I've got my certain standards of what ticks my box in fishing.
Yeah.
You know, for example, you know, I lost those 450s in the church, and I hadn't caught any of those because there's this mad thing that if you own a lake, for some reason you can't fish for your own fish. Can't tell you why. It's not about they're my pets, because I love seeing other anglers catch them, but for some bizarre reason, many lake owners would tell you they can't fish their own fish. Yeah. I was on the pier fishing for small carp, I was catching carp from £8 that were uncaught, hoping and praying we'd get one in the 30s. Yeah. When four of my 50s died, in the church. You can't compare, the fish in the pit to the wonderful fish in the church. I would rather have been on the pit fishing for those unknowns than being in the church fishing for those amazing 50s. But, that makes me bizarre, isn't it? But that's my personal thing that ticks my box. And that's why I won't get into all the politics, all the slagging of what counts and what doesn't. I actually think that a lot of people who shout from the rooftops about big foreign fish or big fish that allegedly don't count because they're simos or whatever, they just try and protect their own little once in a while when they might have caught something. They're in this little club. It's like Yately. I once wrote in Carpwell that if I could be bothered, I'd go down and hammer it. Deliberate comment. And did I get a slag? But the point was that there was that little click down there that, that unless you fished at Yately, it didn't count. And I was talking to one angler who was very proud. He'd been down there for 2 years, but he'd never caught a fucking fish.
And he was bragging about two-year blank.
Bragging to me that he'd blanked for 2 years. And there's all this elitism and all these people that, once in their life might have got lucky with no ability to catch a fish, and they try and protect that image for themselves. It's rubbish. Anna said to me the other day he's booked a session on acting in December. I don't know what point he's trying to make, but I knew exactly where he's going. He's giving two fingers up to all these nasty people and all these talking about death threats. I hadn't heard this before.
They threatened to rape his wife and kids.
Oh well.
I think a phone call suicide.
Phone calls to PB Products who've been sponsoring him, the phone calls to them, people were saying him and the fish should catch AIDS, oh, you name it, it was said. I've never seen anything like it. The vitriol, it was as bad as the Brexit stuff on the internet. It was horrendous, and I've never seen the internet blow up as much. And
in a way, I can understand it about Brexit, because this is people's livelihoods, you know, but we're talking about car, for God's sake. Excuse me, I want to go get an extra one.
One of the things that's come up in discussion about this is George, shut that door, it's broken, didn't it? One of the things that came up about this is that ordinary people's access to big fish is quite limited. Now, most people are never going to get a chance to fish for a record fish because they're in dead man's shoes. Where's the current sort of record live? It's Wazing. It's got like a 15-year waiting list, and it's a never waiting list now. Unless you know people, there's no chance of even getting on the list. It seems to be the only big fish, really big fish, that the average guy is going to ever be able to fish is your commercial lakes. You know, you've opened up some very big fish here after many years of not wanting to open it to the general public because it was kind of yours. You've ended up doing that. You've got places that have manufactured big fish, places like Home Fen, and obviously Rob Hales' waters, he's done exactly that, he's manufactured it legally, I believe, these days. They're all Fenland fisheries fish, but they are fast growing Israeli fish that they sell, same fish that are in Home Fen that has done big 60s now. I think
that's what I meant.
The big fish of the future are going to come from commercial lakes.
That's what I meant.
The shortcut.
James, sorry, just that's what I meant, because I was aware that I wasn't putting it across properly before. Me personally, and it's not a judgment of anyone else, but I would not want to fish for Israeli fish or Portuguese fish in England. I want to fish for fish that I know have been reared in England. Yeah, that's a personal thing, I stress again. But I would not knock anyone else who wants to.
That's the bit that's been missed, is we spoke about this briefly the other day, and I think we pretty much nailed the subject, but we haven't done it on the Carpcast. But fishing's very personal. Now, some people might be a great angler, might have immense ability, but they're a busy working man, three kids, a job 9 to 5, they're working 50, 60 hours a week, and they get a chance to go fishing 2 weeks a year, maybe. Now, that guy, there should be waters out there where he can pay £1,000, £1,500 or whatever for a week. He can go to France, or he can do the same thing in England and fish, what I would consider more of a holiday type venue, you know, like a special place where he can.
It's what the cops in the church was about, I guess pride is not emotional, but I guess I'm proud that I've held down a full-time job, well, more than a full-time job, 60-hour week probably over the years. I'm probably been paid below the minimum wage for the hours I've done. But I've held down that job, and I've still managed, in my mind, to have caught some pretty damn good fish along the way. If I was a full-time angler, I would have caught at least as many as the heroes, if you like. But I wasn't. I chose that I wanted more out of life than just to be sitting on a bank all my life. I wanted other things like a family and all that, and relationships, and I wanted to achieve various things more than fishing. But I recognise that just because you have to work doesn't mean you haven't got the ability to achieve, and that's really what the cops in the church is about. That's why I've always wanted to keep it limited, to give that guy who has chosen a different path and been a full-timer the opportunity to catch a real cracking fish.
There's an argument to say, there's a school of thought that somebody, an angler that catches a 50 pounder from a slightly manufactured sauce, such as like an Avenue type place or a Home Fen or somewhere like that. An argument to say that has about as much merit as a full timer that camps out for 4 years on Burfield or the car park, which no normal guy can ever do, unless you give up your life, your job, your everything. If you spend 7 days a week on the bank in search of, I don't know, you know, Arthur from Yateley, as it was back in the day, or any of those lakes, the Marys of the world, the lakes the full times lived on, they're also in an exclusive group of a handful of anglers that chose to give up a normal life to catch a big fish. I mean, that's not accessible to a normal guy, is it? Like,
so it is accessible to a normal guy, but are those people normal? Yeah, but let's not get into that. But
so
you'll see the headlines in the cart or whatever. Oh, caught 5 years to catch that card. Yeah, sorry, is that a medal? Yeah, is that mean you've got a hand in the bidder? Terry Hearn once said to me that you learn the water in 2 months, so you then should catch what you want.
Yeah.
And I thought, yeah, he's right. It takes me 2 months to learn the water.
Yeah.
That's a year.
Yeah.
You know, this isn't a knock at Terry. What I'm saying is, he made it
2 years and 6 days a week. Is
2 months of fishing. So 60 days you've learned a lake.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so for me, that was a year and a half, actually. I was fishing 45 nights.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And Terry Hearn can learn a lake in 60 days. You know, he's that damn good. You know, but for me, that was a year and a half. You know, so I see the difference there.
I hadn't thought about this before, but I'm thinking about it now. So, like, if a full-timer, like a full-on full-time angler that's given up everything, you know, normal life to live on the lake, pretty much, their captures, there's an argument for their captures counting as little as, you know, somebody catching a ready-made mega fish from an artificial manufactured fed lake. I mean, you see where I'm going? It's like, it doesn't relate to a normal fishing circumstance for any other normal guy that fishes 2 days a week, 40 nights a year, 30 nights a year. Like, it's not an equivalent because, you might see a Terry Hearn or a Daryl Peck or someone catch the big one, you know, you might see him in the paper once a year, once every 2 years or something, but they've done 5 years of fishing for a normal guy during that time, so they should maybe be disregarded as much as maybe the guy catching a 70 from the Avenue or somebody catching Captain Jack from Home Fen at £65 or £66.
Well, I wouldn't say disregarded, but I don't.
It should be held in the
right balance of esteem should be.
Does it mean anything if a full-timer catches a big fish? Because they're full-time. It's nobody else can relate to that other than other full-timers.
Here's another point for you. There's, I think, a pleasing aspect of carp fishing has been it's not all about the 50s or whatever. There's a big following towards pretty fish, scaly fish, whatever. And with Royston, it was very apparent when we first opened it, I've caught an original.
Yeah.
Even though it might have been 15 or 20 pound. That's the big thing at Royston, I've caught an original.
Every lake of fish is like that, you have the originals and the stockies, don't you?
So, the average guy is trying to establish merit for them. See what I mean?
Yeah.
So, because they can't, for whatever reason, fish for 50s, they're making their own standards.
And this is
what ticks their boxes. This is really what I'm on about.
And this has happened with the Urban Banks sort of thing as well. People have these, not necessarily big carp, but just carp from different overlooked places, park lakes, canals, are now becoming desirable. Even the size is irrelevant, isn't it?
Well, you look at what's happened with Alan, and Alan's made a massive movement with Urban Banks. He did a tackle, he did an opening day in a tackle shop, Rachel, I call her my sister, best friend in Bury St Edmunds in Suffolk, a few weeks ago. A lad got on a bus at Chelmsford, I went all the way to see Alan. Alan's become the hero of those youngsters who can't even afford a day ticket.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're on with these like park lakes or canals, these free places, you know, where they've got to set their standards much lower. It might be a skaggy old £10 or whatever, but you know, it means so much to them. And so someone's Alan's relating to them, you know, and he's made their fishing, you know, meritorious. Yeah. You know, I think it's fantastic. I think it's absolutely fantastic that you know, they now feel, wow,
yeah,
you know, what they do is important. Yeah, yeah. So it all goes back to the beginning, James. I mean, I'm not going to judge anyone.
Yeah.
You know, and how dare people say your fish counts or it doesn't?
Fishing is personal, Dave.
It's very personal.
Watching
in the reach of so many different people for different reasons.
Well, you've been very quiet over there, Roger, but you said something to one of your friends on the phone yesterday that it probably sums it all up, and that's, you know, you might catch your biggest fish, but you also catch your personal best, and your personal best is not necessarily your biggest fish, it's the fish that meant the most to you, isn't it? It's like, which is achievement. You can catch, if you dropped on Raysbury, and caught Mary on your first night, on your first session, that's a stunning fish, and one that some people have spent years trying to catch before he died. But like, that might not be considered, you personally might not consider it the same as the fish it took you 3 years to catch.
Yeah.
You know, learning every single habit about that fish, even though for most people it might have been their personal best. But your personal best is, it's personal, it's the one that
yeah.
you really
put your soul into. I often get into the conversation when it comes to personal best. You know, everyone seems to assume that, oh, what's your personal best, and straight away you feel like you're obliged to say your biggest fish. You know, and I always say to people, well, what do you mean, you know, my personal best? Do you mean the biggest fish, or do you mean what's my personal best? Because they're two separate things, you know, sometimes.
And Roger, I'm sure your personal best will be the one that you felt was the biggest achievement.
Of course.
Not necessarily.
That's what it's all about. Yeah. I mean, and that might be, it might be a little, you know, a club lake that's only got four fishing, and you've heard about a big fish, and you've tried to catch it for couple of seasons, eventually you're caught. It might only be 18-20 pounds, but then again, you can go to a day to keep water, you know, a linear fisheries or a Christchurch, and you can cast out and you can catch it on up to 30. But really, how much effort have you put in to catch it? You know, it's personal best is
just struck me. Have you ever gone for the emotion that you go on the water and bang, you've caught that target in minutes? Yeah, have you ever gone for the motion that, damn, you know, I almost didn't go through enough time and pain?
Yeah, I like that.
We shouldn't, should we? Because that's damn good angling.
Well, I fished.
I have.
I fished a really well-known water in Cheshire called Top Flash through the '90s, and it was the main water at that time. All the, you know, the Bernard Loftuses, the Frank Warwicks. Everyone was fishing it, and they were fishing it for a couple of years really before I found out where it was and fished it. And I happened to go there for the last 9 days of this particular season. It was a fishing season, the sort of the old season at the time. I went for the last 9 days of the season. I ended up catching the big one on my second bite, and I remember at the end of that season, I just thought, you know, should I go back or should I not bother? But I wanted to go back just to prove that I could catch them consistently, just to prove it wasn't kind of, you know,
fluke.
Anyone could say, oh, well, you know, second bite.
And I'm sure they did.
You flew, yeah, well, yeah. But, you know, I went back the next year and had more bites than anybody I'd ever had in previous years. But it was just something that I had to do for myself, you know, before I moved on to anywhere else.
Key word, I had to do it for myself.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Is, that's something, I mean, Roger's been somebody that we've not had on the Carpcast yet, gets requested a lot because we tease him quite a bit, but that's pretty much the story of your fishing career. I've gone onto a lake and caught more than everybody else, pretty much every lake you've ever fished in since the 80s. There's a story that I've told a number of times on the podcast that I've basically copied what you've told me and probably got it wrong over the years because I'm getting old now, but tell us a story about when it might have been the top flash. It was one of those lakes where you'd gone down and fished next to like the superstars of the era, which was, I think, Bernard and Frank and stuff, and your bait had gone vinegary or something the night before.
No, that wasn't top flash. That was I think it was only about 15, 16. I was fishing on a local lake in Altrincham, King George's, and I was only a young lad, and there was a couple of older blokes there that used to fish it regular, and I sort of looked up to them. They used to catch consistently, and I heard rumours that they were going to the waters around the northwest. And I think what it is, if as you go through your carp fishing life, if you see other kids that are really keen, I mean, you see lots of like young kids on the bank, and if you see someone that's really keen, and you can see that they've got the potential to be a good angler, then you'll spend a little bit of time with them. And I think that's what's
in your help.
And I think that's what they've seen in me, Kevin and Graham Lally. They are, I mean, a lot of the Northwest lads from the area will know their names, and they seen that I was really keen, and that, you know, I had all the enthusiasm about it. And they said to me one day, do you want to come to Pilsworth Reservoir, which is another well-known water in the Northwest. I knew they'd been fishing there. It was a water that was open in the close season. You know, a lot of water closed. It was the traditional time. So I said, yeah. So they said to me, you know, right, we'll go on a certain day. So this is the early days of boilies. This, you know, there was not really many ready-made boilies about. So I had to make my own. I made my own bait. It was only a basic mix of assembly and a base bait with maple cream flavour. I rolled up 300 baits, and at the time I was working for the post office, and I made my bait, I left it out to dry. When I went to bag it up in the evening, it had all gone, well, I thought it had gone off. It was like it had white spots over it, it smelled vinegary. It was a case of, right, well, you know, that's the way it is, I'm going to have to use that tomorrow. So I took it to Pilsworth. Kevin and Graham picked me up the next day, took it to Pilsworth. And over the next couple of days, I fished in the middle of the two of them. Now, I don't know, probably, maybe Kevin, who knows more about bait than what I do, might have an explanation about what happened, but these baits smell like vinegar. And over the next 2 days, we was all fishing next to each other. The fish were clearly going over their baited areas. They were going straight down on mine. They literally could not resist my bait. I don't know what was coming off it. It was, whether it was amino acids or pH level, but over the next 2 days they caught nothing. I caught, I think it was 21, 22 fish, and it was the only time ever, I think, in all the time I fished, when I could honestly say I had a bait that the fish could literally not resist.
Perhaps the key is vinegar, acid, and then the pH.
I think it was the acid.
Yeah. But to a pH, you know, this helps.
But to a normal man, if he smells it, he just smelled vinegary. He smelled, it was a vinegary smell to it. It was white bits.
What do you reckon caused it?
Like, well, I left them out in the sun because it was a postman at the time. I rolled them, I put them out to dry, and I went to bed. And then in the evening, when I got up to put them away, they'd sweated, the heat had been on them, and they'd gone off, I thought, you know what I mean?
Can I just say, completely aside here, you know, to the listener, Jamie, as you know, it's the first time I met Roger, but, you know, clearly knows his stuff, and I made the connection, tell you how I'm a postman, you know?
Did you know that? Because of the hours it gave you to fish,
or maybe postman licking stamps or whatever, or yeah, just get carp, you know. But no, it's an interesting one. I suspect that's just one of those red letter days of the pH. You know, pH is so important.
Yeah, I think it's just
I remember, you know, the similar story. We was messing around with aminos in the 70s, and spent a fortune on these various aminos, and I knocked up this amino bait, and I went to layer, and Phil Harper's fishing next to me. I had 50 takes that day. He was casting his baits right on top of mine and couldn't bite. And I never repeated it. that never worked again.
Mm.
You know, I don't know why, whether I just was casting it on a snail bed with a pH and aminos and everything was right, but I'll never forget that. 50 takes in a day. It was ludicrous. You know, yeah. Just imagine having 50 takes in a day. And Phil Harper and me were just laughing our heads off. And he was literally casting his baits as near as he could to mine. He couldn't vibe by it. And I never did it again with that bait. It never worked other than that day.
I had a similar occurrence with the first time I ever used a Scopex squid. It was after Dave Levy had introduced me to yourself and Gary. He brought me down here 15 years ago. I did my first article in whatever Dave Levy was writing in, Advanced Carp or Crafty Carp or something. He was doing like interview pieces, interviewed me, introduced me to yourself and Gary, brought me down here. I got on the bait, I took the Scopex squid home, did my first ever pre-baiting campaign since I was a young kid in the 80s. I'd gone on the wire in the northwest, and I baited three times every other day. Three separate occasions. So I baited three times over 6 days. I baited every other day, and then went back and fished a three-night session, and had a red letter session. I had a season's worth of fish in 3 days.
Well, the difference being, I bet that carried on going.
We're
talking about times where
I don't know, but the thing that reminded me of it was what you were saying about the other guy casting baits into your thingy. So there was my ticket ran out on the day that I left.
Right.
It ran out at midnight that night, so I was leaving at lunchtime. It was like a swim in the corner, so the guy around the other bank could cast to my spot if he wanted to. Mm-hmm. And it was two lads set up there that I know pretty well from Stoke, Salty and Benno. This lad, Jason Salt, I put my marker out to read it. I was having one last cast, literally. I'd had about six fish that morning. I was having one last cast. I was like, next bite, I'm going home, and that's my ticket finished. I was never going back to that lake again. So I said, right, I'll put my marker out. I'll cast 2 foot in front of it from my side. You cast 2 foot from your side. And when I've gone, like, you're fishing the spot over the pre-bait, and you'll carry on catching fish as I did. Anyway, so he cast his bait, like within 2 foot, so we're in like a little square area around my marker. He cast to it. I had two more bites off that spot before, while his bait was sat there. Two more bites off that spot. I was like, right, great, see you later, enjoy your season on here, I'm done. I was on 12 stole that year. It took him 2 days to get a bite off that spot. Now I believe that they ignored his bait until they cleaned up every bit of my bait, and then they went on to his bait afterwards.
There's 2 points say that. Me and Roger talking about bizarre situations where, you know, an amazing result happens and you don't know why, and you don't repeat it, but you know, that was you pre-baiting with an awesome bait. If you could have stayed there, you would have just won.
Of course, yeah. Well, it was interesting, when I stopped putting it in, he didn't get a bite for 2 days off the same spot.
Mm.
And I believe they just ate all my bait first and then moved on to it.
Which goes on to the other point. It stuns me. In the phone calls I get, in reading magazines, you know, I think I mentioned it with Chili. So it happens on Carcast, how a significant number of anglers do not understand the difference of real quality bait. It can be an edge.
Yeah.
You know, and how many people are prepared to just try and find the cheapest bait they can, which relates to some of this direct sale we've talked about.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I've always said the cheapest bait is the most expensive bait in the world when you're blank. Yeah. And they just don't get it. They just don't get it. You know, all my life I've invested my money in bait. When I was in my 20s, you know, with a young wife and still an apprenticeship, yeah, I was spending more on bait than I was on fishing tackle by far, you know, because I knew the importance of it. You know, it is so important, you know, without a decent bait and then how you apply it, and the next, it's location, decent bait, and then rigs, I'm sure. Well, I hope Roger will agree. Yeah, but I'm just stunned in this modern carp scene how they don't understand the importance of bait as an edge.
I think
it just goes back to the same thing. They just all, you know, lock into the going bait. And so, you know, I must have said so many times, I must be boring people. You know, if you fish like everyone else, you'll catch like everyone else. So why the hell do you want the same bait as everyone else on the lake?
Yeah.
You know, and I want an edge. I want an edge with my bait. I've always wanted an edge with my bait. It's always been so important to get that edge. And it goes back, you know, I listened to your John Baker.
John Baker, yeah.
And that brought out so many memories. I can tell you some great stories about John because, you know, he's a little bit younger than me, but he was a BCSG member when I was, or after me, you know, and I used to go up to the meetings in his area, Hertfordshire, you know, and I got to know the lad, you know, and it kind of reminded me of what I'd forgotten, you know, and, you know, John is a real bait specialist now, especially in flavours,
yeah.
And that's because the only way we caught carp was by learning about making bait, you know, simple as that, you know, and I don't think a large number of modern carp anglers understand that. You know, we couldn't go in a shop and buy a boilie. You know, we couldn't go in a shop and buy carp bait ingredients. You know, John referenced Bait 78, which, you know, as I said to you, it was the first shop, but John didn't own it, he was their consultant. You know, but pre-Bait 78, there was no availability of carp bait in a tackle shop. You know, we spent hundreds and thousands of hours, you know, researching and experimenting and mixing our own baits.
And that's something people don't do now. You never get that learning curve, do you, anymore? But because you go and buy the switch, you know.
They do. But what is interesting, you know, you have Mike Wilmot on there.
Yeah.
You've had John on there.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have Dave Moore.
Yeah.
Dave Moore, someone told me recently, said, at last the bait company has had the bollocks to bring out a proper bait. He's talking about Key.
Mm.
Yeah? All those old school anglers who went through that apprenticeship, that period of having to do the graft, understand about all the elements of a bait and the ingredients you had to put together to make a success, understand the difference quality bait makes. Now we live in a world where they just go in the shop and buy it off a shelf, and they just don't get it.
Mm.
They just don't understand it because they haven't gone through. You know, this is what my book was about. You know, my Memoirs of Carp Fisher was, in essence, a progress of mine to pick waters and try and show anglers the learning curve we went through, the apprenticeship I went through. You know, and now these instant carp anglers, sadly, have not had all that experience.
There is no learning curve now. You look in the press, social media, you see, oh, there's this lake's got 1040s and a 50, so I'll join that lake, I'll buy this bait from manufacturer if you're lucky, or from a tackle shop, you know, a name bait that you know works, fish a lake, you know where the fish, you know the fish's names, where they already live, and put in enough time, you're going to catch them regardless of ability. It's just the better ability you've got, probably the less time it takes to catch, but so you're probably going to catch it.
They're utterly ignorant, dare I say, and informed. Yeah, when we brought out the Key, yeah, the amount of slag in that bait got, how much?
Because of the price, yeah.
And I tried to point out that do not use even half the amount you would normally use because it's so rich, which basically makes it exactly the same value as an average bait or less. Yeah. I remember one guy, you're having a laugh, I always use 2 kilos over each rod. Yeah, just some people, yeah, you just never go, yeah. But like I say, yeah, but they're so opinionated, just like.
But they wouldn't know that the HMV boom in the 80s, what a difference that made to car base. It means nothing to them, does it? So when you go, I'm releasing an HMV bait, like the old school one, unfortunately it's going to cost this much, we're not making much off it, but it has to be £15 a kilo. Everything you said before £15 a kilo has gone straight through somebody's ears and out the other side, because, and the people that do go, yeah, that's brave, they're the people that have already got bait companies, bait deals, and you know, they're already, generally, those people are already quite far up the carp angling tree. So I think as a concept, it's brilliant. As a marketing thing, the majorities are probably never going to see it. They're never going to accept what it is because they just don't know.
A couple of weeks ago, Jamie, I went on some mad downer. Yeah, I'm not a person who has depression, and I wasn't depressed, but for some reason I went on this mad downer for 24 hours. It was after 3 phone calls in a row on the phone. Yeah, mm-hmm. As you know, I run the customer line. But this mad downer was about, I've wasted my whole life. Yeah. Yeah. The point of it was, I was in this really, low state was, I've tried to spend my whole life helping and teaching anglers, and I come to the conclusion it's a complete waste of time. All that knowledge that we accrued has actually gone backwards and has not been passed on or listened to at all. We have this new world who just had not grasped anything that we learned and used it to their advantage. It's gone backwards.
We're talking about the Big Brother X Factor Brigade and just spoon-fed what they're told or marketed, I guess.
You got kids telling me I'm a bloody idiot and I don't know what I'm doing. Yeah, nothing worth an opinion. Oh, dear.
It must be frustrating. I mean, I know you answer the customer line, don't you?
It is very frustrating.
If I were to speak to you now, sometimes you don't answer your mobile. I'll just ring the Nash line and press zero. And I get through to him every time.
Because I've been passionate about the sport all my life, and I want to, I'm past it now. I'm old. I haven't got the physical abilities I used to have. When I used to go fishing with Adam, it was great because he just wanted to catch loads. I could never get my head around why you want to catch 10 doubles over a 40. So it was great. He used my pest control, he catch the 10 little ones and I'd catch the big one. But unfortunately, along the way, the bug had got the big fish bug. I can't compete with him now because he's on 10 cans of Red Bull or whatever, and he's on, he's roaring around like a raven. And so basically, I accept now, I'm old, I'm past it. The only thing I've got left to do is pass on all my knowledge, but no fucker wants to listen.
Oh,
it's funny.
People are, generalising a little bit, but there is, it's marketing more than anything. People like
brainwashing,
they like comfort, this seems to be the best selling bait, everybody seems to be using this particular bait and everyone's joining Wellington Country Park or this particular name lake, and I'm going to buy the Danny Fairbrass rods and me whatever Bezier reels or whatever, and I'm going to go and do
it's it but, a tip for the future. I'm so enjoying Roger's story when he was a young lad. I had this lady, turns out to be a mum, ring me up a few weeks ago, wanted to order a copy of my book for her 12-year-old son.
Yeah.
Which kind of interested me because after I put my heart and soul into that book, I was really deflated when we brought it out to understand that so few people were reading that. So I was quite fascinated.
Remind me, I've got a point on that, but yeah, go on.
So I was quite fascinated that she was buying a book for a 12-year-old son, and she said, I was really into carp fishing, blah, blah, blah. And so I organised for her to have a book, and because it sounded like her son was so keen, I sent him down a little gift for me, blah, blah. Then a week later, phone rings, and it's Ollie, this 12-year-old, really beautifully spoken, well-mannered lad, who took the time and trouble to ring me up and thank me, that I've been good enough to send him a little gift, blah, blah, blah. And I said to him, how are you getting on the book? Like I said, very cynical that no one reads nowadays. He said, I've only got 8 pages left, Kevin. He said, oh wow, he said, it's been so funny. He said, I've loved it. And he then went on and said, he said, I really got into your chapter about rigs and hooking length, and I've been hooking all the fish are laying on the edge of my lips, so I lengthened the hook length, I think he said an inch and a half. He said, the next one I got was dead bang centre, an inch back.
Yeah,
and I thought, just like you're saying, Roger, here's a kid that's listening. So I started giving a bit of TLC on the email. Cut a long story short, the lad lives in Dorset. He's got his dad driving him up, and he's been to Royston twice now. I'm gutted that the first time I was in Portugal, and the second time last weekend, I've done my back and couldn't get up to see him. Mm. But here's a tip for the future. This little lad, Ollie, is going to be an angler to look out for in his 20s. He's got it.
Shout out to Ollie.
Why I know he's got it? Because he's listening, and so few of them do.
Well, I hope he's listening to the Carpcast, because shout out to Ollie, you get all the info here, and the main man Kevin Nash, who just picked you up. Talking about rig lengths there, Roger uses the longest hook links. I see an average guy cast out is a 12 inches plus. You're talking about long hook links. I went through a craze, and I think a lot of people did, using really short hook links, like sort of 4 to 6 inches average. I know you like a long hook link, and I watch your rigs, Roger. When you cast them out, they look like a helicopter going out, because you get the rig swinging so it doesn't tangle, and you can see the boilie swinging at a decent sort of arc all the way out. So, A, you're confident it's not tangled, but are there any other reasons why you're using a longer hook link?
I think it's just a natural progression from fishing the Cheshire Maze, which is, you know, obviously wetland fish.
Silty
Maze. We've just always used longer hook lengths. I mean, King George's, you've fished there before, what is it, 2 foot, 3 foot deep and a foot of silt. So again, long hook lengths. This session that I've just done in the last couple of days, you've used probably the shortest hook lengths that I've used for a while.
Hello.
Probably, what's that?
8.5, 9.
Yeah, 8.5, 9 inches. And that's quite short for me, you know what I mean? So, I don't know, I'm not scared of using short hook lengths if I think the situation, you know, obviously if you're on something solid, gravel, firm clay, anything like that, then yeah, I'll go short. I always look at your hook lengths and always think, oh my God, what's it casting out?
when I went to France with Reedy this year, Reedy uses really long hook links and really long hairs. And he said to me on this session, actually, I spoke to him on the phone yesterday, and he went, you're not using them short hook links, are you? Big fish don't like them. But do you think there's something in the fact that big carp find it easier to, you know, we hook them better with longer hook links just because of their physical dimensions of big mouth, you know, sucking from further away? Do you think longer hook links hook big carp?
No, I don't think longer hook lengths hook big carp. I think it's just the situation that you're fishing in. I mean, I'm not scared.
It's just about the bottom.
Yeah, it's all about the bottom. I'm not scared to use a short hook length. You know, if it's solid, I mean, I've chucked some really short ones out recently, you know, in the last couple of days.
Roger, Mr. Nash just left the room to have a pee. As he went out, he said, how long? I said, 8.5, 9, you agreed,
yeah.
Which is my optimum length. Out of interest, why do you come down then from your 12s when you come here to 8.5, 9?
Why do they come down? Well, I thought it was, I've had a feel around on the lake, and what firm, it's firm, it's really firm. I mean, I thought it was gravel, but your book, I mean, Jamie said that, you said it's
hard clay.
It's hard clay, that's got some sort of ripple effect over it. Yeah, anything firm like that, I'm putting a small bag on, firm bottom, there's just no need to have a long hook length. I mean, I've got it, I think, long enough. I've got quite a long hair in them as well. You've seen the hair, because every time I've cast it out, it's been...
I've seen you've had some like wafters, like pretty big barrel shaped wafters.
Yeah. That's probably that sort of length.
3 inches?
From the end of the...
What's the separation between the back of the bait and the bend then?
Back of the bait and the bend is about 2 inch.
Is it?
Mm. Yeah.
It's still quite long, isn't it?
But it is for me.
I think bigger carp, like bigger mounts, you need more separation.
That's it. I'm fishing for an average, the average size fish I'm fishing for down at the lake is a lot bigger than I'm normally fishing for. So.
I've always said a minimum of 1/2 inch.
Yeah.
However, yeah, and... I think it's, you know, the colder boys, you know, we're really banging this 4-6 inch hook length thing. And in the past, I'll say I was critical, because all I've ever caught is pasties on that length, you know. And unless it's silk, as you're saying, the optimum I proved over 20 years to my own satisfaction is 8.5 to 9. And yeah, I've gone in a print and, you know, said that really short hook links, unless you need to bang them into silt because they're feeding the silt, you know, it just don't work. But the pit changed everything.
The pit, snake pit?
No, the pit I mentioned earlier, you know, the big pit with me and Andy on the 100-acre job. Yeah, we've put it together, we finally got them on bait, and a lot of it was really shallow water, and we'd have them over our base, sometimes towels out of the water, couldn't get a bite. Yeah, and it was clearly a presentation thing. Yeah, I think it's more probably natural presentation because they're riggy. And to be honest, it was Anna that sussed it, because I did not have the width of mind to, because of all my years of conviction. And the going method at the pit is a 3 to 4 inch hook link with the bait tight to the hook. And that's the thing for me. Yeah, if you want to not convert fish, not get the hook to turn and have runs and you just strike in the midair, have the bait tight to the hook. Give me your view on that in a minute, Roger. But that is the only rig that is effective at the pit. And I come to the conclusion it's brackish water and it's full of prawns, well, not prawns, shrimps. And we could never catch over silt. We can only catch on hard stone, sorry, on stony areas where there's quite a lot of stones. And I reckon the shrimps live under those stones, and the carp literally got their mouths right on the deck and they're pushing the stones and grabbing the shrimps underneath, and that's why that rig works. So the point I'm making is, and I put my hand up after all these years of criticising people, you know, for using short rigs or baits tight at the hook, they may be in a situation where it worked and I just had never come across that, so I'm wrong. But have you ever found a water where you can catch on 3-4 inch rigs and a bait nailed tight to the shank?
I did, and I'll give you an example. I was fishing with you, Roger, and this is the reason why I've used short rigs ever since, and probably where I would have been better using long rigs. But it was Elstow 1, and you maybe know, Kevin, you've probably known a few anglers that have fished there over the years, but you'll certainly know, Roger, the going method, that basically this is a well-stocked lake, decent average size, you know, lots of 30 pluses, lots of 40s, and the going method for years has been hemp and pellet. So people would fish tiny hooks,
yeah, tight spot.
Yeah, tight spot, 3 rods on the spot, and they would. You had to fish a tight spot because the lake's 40 foot deep, and then you get a clay hump that comes up to 15 foot, 12
foot. You get bite-offs if you don't do that.
Yeah, but you can't, if you drop it in the 40 foot, you're not getting a bite, and the features are coming up to 15 foot, and they're only small, a lot of these features. You get 3 rods on them, but it's not a big area. So accurate baiting, fishing 3 rods very tight on one, there might only be one spot in the swim, that's what I'm talking about. So you had no option but to fish 3 rods on an area. They used to bait very tightly. They put a bucket full of basically hemp and pellet, and it was when fake plastic corn first came out and everybody was using it. They were using small hooks, one bit of fake corn, catching 30 and 40 pound carp over hemp and pellet.
But was it tied to the bend of the hook? That's the point.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Maybe half an inch.
Short hook links work in various situations.
Yeah, I've never
caught with baits tied to the hook.
No, you're right there. Yeah. The knee separation.
I'm talking fixed to the hook.
Yeah. I thought you were talking about the length of the actual hook link.
Have you, Roger?
I have, yeah. I have caught
six.
Yeah, obviously you got six, but I remember years ago when we fished somewhere not far from here, actually, down in the Big Lake. When it was the original Down, we had a rig that was it was a homemade sea lead with about 3 or 4 inches of stiff tubing coming out the back. So the whole thing was about 6 inches long, all completely rigid. And we used to fish a hook length off the front of that was only 4 inches long. Now that hook length would be a pop-up rig. It'd have putty halfway down, 2 inches down the hook length. And
I can kind of get that because I think pop-up rigs are a lot different.
It would be.
I'm talking bottom bait rigs.
Oh right. Yeah. Well, this was a pop-up rig with the pop-up.
Yeah, we do. Yeah,
tight to the.
Yeah,
back
we
of the
do, hole. Don't we? But with pop-ups, but that's a different mechanics.
But not with bottom bait.
Not
rigs,
with
no.
bottom bait.
No, no.
Yeah, and you know, like I said, the lesson has learned me that sometimes a situation can be something we could never ever understand or come across before, so you've got to have a completely open mind with rigs. Like I said, I wouldn't have sussed that rig. It was Dan that sussed it because he's got a much more open mind to his fishing. He's not a long term carp angler. Yeah,
I think when you're fishing with some rigs, you've got to decide whether you're trying to catch fish a certain way. Are you trying to catch them on movement?
Yeah.
Or you try to catch them on ejection, where you know obviously the fish is sussed that he's picked some up. It picks something that's foreign up and it's trying to blow it out, and you might try and prick it and hook it like that, or you're going to try and
hook it on movement where the fish has got it in its mouth and it turns its head and it tries to, and you hook it that sort of way. If I'm ever trying to catch a fish on ejection, then there's always got to be space between the bait and the hook, because obviously you've got to allow the bait to
travel
and then obviously pull
the bait to travel. But also, you know, the big thing for me is the hook turning and pricking, because it's tight to the bait, it's so difficult. The bait's tight on the shank, it's so difficult for it to turn.
Well, if you've got a bait that's tight to the shank, then I would always be trying to hook fish on movement rather than...
It's going to come out back job-wise, isn't it?
Yeah, if you give a fish a chance to blow it out, it's going to turn the hook.
Mm.
And you're not going to hook it, are you?
Do you ever tell you about my 6-inch hairs?
No.
I was on a certain lake, and it was actually a conversation with... what's the owner, Crystal? Dave Chilton. Yeah. Because that's a conversation with him, who was fishing really long hairs on mangrove.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started fishing long hairs and I was pushing the limits. I ended up with 6-inch long hairs and was catching well.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, on this particular night, I've turned up and if I thought about it, what I did was ludicrous, but I thought I'm going to give him a load of bait tonight. So I put 3 kilos over each rod in like a foot diameter, and then fished these 6-inch long hair rigs. And I had a take in the middle of the night and the fish fought like hell. I thought I'd got the real big one, but I hadn't actually. It was a mid-20. Landed it and I've realised I forgot my torch. And so I felt down the line into its mouth, and that sick feeling, if you ever had it, I couldn't feel the hook. The line just went down. I was absolutely gutted. So I thought there was nothing I could do, it's dark. So I cut the hook link, put it in a sack, and as soon as there's enough light, you know, because I was awake after night stressing about it, got up, got the fish out of the sack. As I got the fish out of the sack, I had this stinging sensation in my finger. And the hook was in his belly and it had gone through. And it pricked my finger.
Mm.
It had taken that hair in, blown it out his gill cover, and I'd hooked it in the belly.
So the line was going through the gills,
and I'd hooked it in the belly. Yeah, and you know, that's what they do, don't they? They're sorting out the good items and blowing out the rest.
You won't remember this, Roger, knowing your memory is pretty bad. But when I just finished on Yateley, there was a craze of really long hook links. Now I'm not talking 6-inch hook links, but certainly 3 to 4-inch hook links, which are still hairs, 3 to 4-inch hairs, so separation from your shank or wherever
by modern day standards, really.
It's really long. You know, like I say, an inch looks long these days, like separation from the bend of the hook to the top of your hook bait. That's quite a long way. Anyway, there was a craze. I believe there's a very secretive guy who's got lakes in the Cotswolds, used to fish on Conningbrook. Tom, I'm not going to say any more of his name, because he does try and keep out the press a lot. I was around this time, this Tom had a rig that he used to hand place on Conningbrook. It was quite well known about from the regulars on there. Nobody knows what this rig is, like, it's not a spoiler, like, I don't know what this rig is. But there was a big craze at the time amongst the elite anglers, I would say, or people who considered themselves elite at the time, the guys that were really going in depth with people, of that long hairs was the secret. It was the edge, like really long hairs, 4-inch, 5-inch hairs from top of the bait to the hook. And I remember telling you about it, Roger, and we were fishing in the winter socials on King George's, which, as you know, was super well stocked at the time.
Mm.
And I think it must have been the Yeti era, because I was fishing Fendrayton at the time, and on Fendrayton I was using the bullet braid that Jim Shelley got me onto, which was like really good for boat fishing and stuff. And I actually, so I'd gone to this lake in George's, which is about 2.5-3 acres, full of 12 pounders to 15 pounder was a good fish at the time, wasn't it? And 18 pound was as big as they were, but it was well stocked, you could get 4 or 5 bites in the winter. And I went there, and I remember having a bet with you for money that I would catch a fish on one of these super long hairs. And I remember putting this rig out. I had, you know, 40 pound bullet braid mainline on this thing, which actually floated when I laid it. It was a very heavy sinking braid, but when it was dry, if you didn't wet it, it would float. And I remember placing this bait by an overhanging tree, walking it up the margin, all the line floating on the surface with a 4 or 5 inch, maybe even 6 inch hair on, like a ridiculous length. And it ripped in the middle of the night. It ripped, and then I tried to land this fish. I ended up losing it on the snag. Somebody else's line was caught off this tree, and the fish was on the surface, and I was pulling it. And you know that feeling when you're snagged on someone else's line, and then you can't get the fish past a certain point. But every time you pull it to the surface, and it flaps on the surface. I lost it after about 15 minutes, and you wouldn't believe me that I'd hooked one on this 4 or 5.
I still don't believe now.
Well, it definitely, you'd never believe me. I never won the bet, but I did. And these fish were 12 to 14, 15 pounds. I was like, it will take a long hair, I promise you. Like, it will still get that in its mouth and hook itself, which it did. I had it on for ages. I only lost it because of this line snag. But it shows how far they're sucking it in, doesn't it?
Yeah. So
12, 13, 14 pound or whatever it would have been. It would have, if it was the biggest fish in the lake, it would have been 18 pound.
Yeah. That's another big subject, you know, just like bait, they've all got to use exactly the same rigs. And you know, I'm just kind of thinking, I forgot, you know, like, I know I mentioned it earlier, but you know, it was a it's a theme throughout Memoirs of a Carp Angler. You know, we go in the water, we find the going method, then we go to another water and establish another going method, and we forget that previous method, you know, i.e. you know, basically, I was using zig rigs in the 80s.
Popped up off the lead.
Yeah, yeah, but we forgot all about that, you know. But you know, where I'm going with this is, you know, you're making me think here, and which is great. You know, I haven't played around those long hairs since, and no one, of course, is. But where I was then going, you're talking about long hook rigs, when I got on the Crumb and PVA bags in the 90s, I was on Star Lane and I was getting played by a bream, and every morning I'm winding a bream on each rod. So my answer was I needed indication. So I went on running leads, and between the PVA bags, the Crumb and the running leads, those were my big edges in the 90s. And I would still say a running lead is a massive edge.
And that's something that's been forgotten about.
On most waters today, the reason I don't use them all the time is because if there's weed around, but if there's ever an opportunity where I feel it's relevant to use a running lead, that is a massive edge. But anyway, to the story. So I'm on the running leads, I'm on these PVA bags, and this was early spring. I'm having to work for a living, back to that, and so I wasn't turning up till after dark. So I'm whacking the PVA bag out, and I caught from basically the second session. I'm really having it off, no one else is on there or catching. But as I've gone into about the fifth or sixth session, lights, you know, levels are increasing, and I actually turned up and cast out before it was dark. I've cast it out, you know, shows how thick I am. I'm using a running lead. You know, the PVA bag has hit the surface and is still on the surface, and the lead has run down a line. In short, I was using 6 foot hook links. Right? Yeah. And I had this massive run of fish. So I've addressed that problem, and now PVAing up the lead.
The lead to the
so
circle, yeah.
So that when I cast out, the PVA bag would pull down, and the PVA would melt. my catch rate dropped 70%.
So you're accidentally using whatever the depth of the lake was how long your hook length was?
Yeah, so you know, I've gone down to like my 8.5-9 inch hook length and my catch rate dropped 70%. Yeah. Whereas before I was on 6 foot hook length and catching really
didn't
well.
Didn't even know it.
Yeah, didn't even know it. Yeah, but,
that's
yeah,
a good one.
But yeah, with all this baiting and carp being caught off and then frightened of beds of bait, it does. You know, I was only thinking about this the other week and that story I just told you. There's a whole area that maybe we ought to exploit at the moment of seriously long hook links.
The first time I met Gary on Fen Drayton fishing and actually saw him fish, he was using 2 foot hook links. And when I said to him, you know, I'm like super keen, I was very keen in those days, 12, 13 years ago, questioned him why he's doing it, and typical Gary style, he went, good, no one else's.
Yeah.
He had no logical reason why two foot links are better than one foot.
No.
But
that,
he was just,
that is a logical reason.
Yeah, because no one else is. It works.
Yeah.
Like, I catch fish on it and it works and no one
and
else.
That's why I was very keen to ask Roger why he shortened his hook links when he came down here.
Yeah.
And, yeah. I wonder what would have happened if you kept your hook links the same length down there. Because I'd have run a fish on the cops, probably going back I'm going back 19 years, Roger, on the cops, when I used 2 foot hook links.
Yeah.
Yeah. But mad thing was, the first foot was stiff. So the foot stiff and the foot slack.
Yeah.
So that's another story. But
Roger has some rigs he won't let me show people. He sends me pictures of rigs he won't let me show people.
He's saying that he used short rigs and my rigs are still, they'd be classed as a long rig for you, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I've used.
Yeah, definitely.
So, it's still.
But this is what we're saying when we're talking about bait before, people buying pre-packed bait and not experimenting with different colours, flavours, flavour levels. You know, because companies don't give us the option to try. Can you try Scopic Squid with half flavouring, three quarters flavouring, double strength flavouring? Like, even, you know, Nashbait doesn't give an average guy the option, unless you're a field tester or somebody that can get a bait tweaked. We're kind of given an off the shelf. Now, you've obviously tested the most popular, but it's kind of the same in all aspects of the fishing. Like, we, you know, your average guy, if he goes out and he catches on his 8-inch hook link, is he ever going to cast a 24-inch hook link out or a 30-inch hook link out? He's probably never going to try that in his lifetime.
You know, carp fishing, didn't you? You know, it's just like what you said with bait. Yeah, we bring out, for example, X bait. Yeah, we then got to do bodies. Sorry, pop-ups. So we've got to do bodies in exercises. We've got to do pop-ups in exercises. And then they want wafters. And then they want various colours of pop-ups, blah, blah. So the problem is the shop has not got the space to stock their gear. And this is where I was being really tongue-in-cheek. It's the same with rigs. They all go in the shops and buy their rig. And so the shop has not got the space to have all these different variations.
Yeah.
Sorry for being cynical, but yeah, and a couple of guys on the cops a couple of weeks ago, after day two, they went down to the local tackle shop and bought chod rigs. Do fucking what? I hope they're not listening to this, but what were they doing on there?
So I'm intrigued about the Golder. We've been talking off air for a little while, after a few beers, but you just mentioned the Golden Waving Frog. I'd like to know what that is.
It's a great story, Johnny. My youngest, he's a real sharp lad, and he just is so informed. Anyway, he comes. You know, the kid is in the tech sector, hackathon industry, and he flies all around the world doing these hackathons. I never know where he is. I never catch up with him, which, as a dad, you know. Anyway, he popped down to see me a month ago, and we went out for lunch, and I was talking about the fact that my frogs seem to have disappeared up the lake. You know, my famous, well, we originally thought those bull frogs, but I've subsequently been told they're a European frog, you know, which I stopped because we recognised the size of the tadpoles, which, believe it or not, about 3 inches long, and the body is 18 mil.
This came from Conningbrook, was it?
These come from Conningbrook. Yeah. We brought some back from Conningbrook. And they also spawn a lot later. And it's one of the, probably the many elements why the fish in the Chirs and Copse are so big. So we get the English fox in February and March. And then we get these
Super frogs,
they spawn in May, June. Yeah, and as I said, the tadpoles are immense size, so what an incredible food source. And they make an incredible noise, in fact.
I've heard it.
Yeah,
you've not seen it, Roger, fishing all these lakes. You fish here in spring.
I've heard about it, I've been waiting to hear it.
It's like Chinese water torture. You're going to go crazy, these frogs make a noise all night. And when you see them jump into the lake, they give you goosebumps, they scare you because they're about a foot long with their legs outstretched.
And as Jamie said, it's like Chinese water torture. Yeah, I stopped fishing it in June, Roger, because the noise used to drive me mad. You know? And they are very territorial. Yeah, and I remember one night, one was right in the reeds in front of me. It was driving me bonkers. I'd get out and, you know, root around the reeds, and they always, like, as soon as they panic, what? And you hear them, those reeds crashing apart like a water buffalo's going. Yeah. Thank God I got rid of that. You just start sleeping again, and bang, they're back. They always go back to the same place, but, you know, I've wanted to kill them so often. But I recognise the benefits of them. 3 years ago, there's less of them croaking, and they are, interestingly enough, all territorial, and they've all got their own voices. Yeah, and I know it might sound mad, but you become to recognise it. There was one that lived in the outlet pipe of the copse. It was the same frog for 4 years. It was so distinctive in his voice, but we're not hearing it. And last year, complete silence. Yeah, I'm really gutted that I lost that food source. Anyway, this is back to the story. I was saying to Joe about this. He said, well, haven't you heard about the golden waving frog, Dad? I went, actually, Joe, no. He said, he mentioned some other frog that had been taken from a country and put in another country, and they had a virus and infected all the frogs, and that virus has gone now all around the world. It's actually infected Irish frogs as well, so they've got the same problem as well, and they are dying out. They either are completely wiped out or they do make a slow comeback. And he said this virus hit this golden waving frog that, if I recall, lives in South America somewhere. Okay, and it had been identified it was in danger of extinction. And so apparently there's an organisation, I'm just trying to remember this as Joe told me, there's an organisation called the ARC, where when they recognise a species is going to extinction, they go into the wild, collect them all and put them into, you know, zoos or whatever to try and get the numbers up, presuming then to put them back in the wild later. He said, well, the ARC were going to go in and get these golden waving frogs and make sure they survived. David Attenborough's here heard about this, and one of his teams went in to film the golden waving frogs in the natural environment before the ARC went in and then, you know, brought them back into captivity and rescued them. So they went in and filmed them, and then the ARC went in and they're all gone. David Attenborough's got the last film, the golden waving frog, before it went into extinction. This is the story Joe told me, Joe. How mad is that? And the reason that it's called the golden waving frog, by the way, is that they're the only amphibian that communicated by movement, in this case hand signals. These frogs stand there like waving their hands, whereas other things croak or whatever. Yeah. So I should have got golden waving frogs up your legs, it didn't make any fucking noise. Too late, all dead now. Is that a good story or what? Look, classic example of my boy. His detail for information is incredible.
Your stories are good. I do enjoy listening to her. And actually, it's hard to convey to people that haven't had the pleasure of sitting here and, you know, having something to eat and a drink with you. But some of the best conversations come out of this situation, you know, when I've, Gary's a good one, you know, Gary's ace for sitting stories, and you often think, I wish I could have recorded that, and I've been fortunate enough to sit with you a few times now and get some of these stories. But
did you get better steak and Stilton pie and brandy to
listen, I bought steak and Stilton pie. And vowed never to buy it again. You said you were cooking steak and Stilton pie for us today, and I knew I could eat it, but I didn't think I would want it again and again and again and again. It was beautiful, wasn't it, Roger?
Yeah, it was really nice.
You was really polite, Johnny, so when I said I'm doing that, you never any time said, oh.
I knew I could eat it because I have eaten it in the past, but I've eaten it and thought Stilton's too strong. I'm not a cheese lover. Like, I can eat melted cheese in burgers and, you know, mixed in with stuff, but I'm not a different. My girlfriend Rachel loves cheese. Like, she has, we have a running argument about what is it? Is it Brie? What, one of the French cheeses?
A liquid one.
She buys a lot, and she like, you might like it. No, I've tasted it. I don't like it. You might like it. Every time she buys it, she makes me no. We fight with her trying to make me taste it, and I won't taste it. I'm like, I'm 43 years old. I know what I like now and what I don't, and I do find new things, but I know I don't like that. Mm. And one of the main things is cheese, and then I don't like Stilton. But I tolerated it in a pie a couple of times that I bought, but I always thought this pie would be better without Stilton every time I've ate it. So when you said you're cooking steak in Stilton, I knew you were a good cook. So straight away I thought, I'm definitely going to try this. Like, there's no way I'm not going to be able to eat it, because I've eaten ones that I don't like, because I like steak pie. Straight away I thought, this is not only nice, if you hadn't have told me it was steak in Stilton, I wouldn't have known straight away. And it's just tasty. It's got a, not to mention the horseradish mashed potato, which was also like quite funky. I like mashed potato and I put different things in it.
It's back to bait, Jamie. You know, the Stilton actually is Rockfall. I did say Stilton, but Dixie, bless her, bought Rockfall instead. It's about just highlighting that tone, you know, and with beef, if you've got a really strong cheese, you can really bring out the tone, the taste, but it's got to be subtle.
It was,
you
know, perfect. You have to be honest, it was like,
you shouldn't be able to recognise it as Stilton. You know, you just got to lift it and think, oh. If I hadn't told you that was Rockfall or Stilton there, would you have guessed it?
No.
No.
But I don't like Stilton, and my wife's actually going to told up this
community. Maybe that's why I think it wasn't a Stilton.
Julie said to me, you don't like Stilton, but it's a really fine line between getting it right and.
It's not different than bait, it's about understanding, you know, food and bait. Food and bait are exactly the same.
It's exactly the same. Like
blending and mixing to get that tone.
I told you earlier that I've worked in I've DJed in a lot of bar restaurants with good restaurants, you know, where they've got chefs, not, you know, £7 an hour chefs, but chefs, proper chefs who've studied their art and are super creative as any bay maker or artist, you know, these people take pride in making a menu. And they've, you know, cooked us a roast dinner that's not like any roast dinner I've ever had. And, you know, being somebody who recognises, is intelligent enough to recognise good things, I always pester people, you know, like, how do you make that taste that nice or whatever. And there's always been a base in everything I've ever asked any good chef, because they make everything taste nice, from a pretty plain pasta to the gravy on a roast dinner to, you know, there's, and they always say there's a base, and the base generally I've found now is olive oil, chili, salt, pepper, garlic. Like that's kind of the base that they make everything on top of, whether they're frying any type of meat, chicken, beef, pork, whatever, that's the base. So I'm thinking, do we have because taste enhancers are so important, you know, what you said about getting the balance of stuff right to make things taste a little bit different. Could we make a bait that's chili, garlic, salt, oil chili, garlic, salt, pepper. As a standard base before we do anything else.
Take out the birds. The ingredients you said there. Yeah, this is now Nash Bait, and why I think we're so different. Like I said, a bait company bring out X Bait. They're hammering it, be on every lake, and it is absolutely true that these kind of baits and this marketing is now lasting a year. You know, but we've also discussed how long squid has lasted. And as you know, squid lasted so long and is still just as relevant today, although anglers don't get that, because of the tweaking Gary did. And this is a perfect example. So the first squid was steak and owl pie.
Yeah.
We love steak and owl pie. Yeah. And you get addicted to steak and owl pie. But unfortunately, every time you ate it, you had a hook in your mouth and got pulled out of the water. And so we had distilling. See where I'm going? Yeah, so the steak and owl pie is your basic...
Your core ingredients, this is not your attractor, right?
But then we add another element to throw you off and make you come back, even though you got a hook in your mouth before. And that is basically the philosophy of Nash, which makes us very different, I think, where we find the winning elements and then we just tweak,
enhance
to throw the carp off the guard on their memory and just keep it long term.
The funny thing Gary always said to me about, I mean, the S-Mix is no doubt, I mean, any other rival bait user knows that the S-Mix... It's proven. I mean, I know from St. Ives that fish got caught 15 times on the squid mix that I know of, and was still getting caught on that bait 5-6 times a year until it died. And it was a bait that never blew.
You mentioned a lady then. You never mentioned a lady, but that was definitely a lady, wasn't it?
You mentioned Warmer at least 3 times before I mentioned the lady. At least.
But I should have had a bet tonight. I'd have been quitting tonight.
That Warmwell came first earlier, about 3 hours ago. I've held off till now. But that fish kept getting caught on the squid mix. Daryl caught it on it, his mate Ginge caught it on it, I caught it on it, Dave caught it on it, everyone we know, right? That bait never blew on that lake. And that fish used to come out anything from 7 to 10 times a year. But 89% of it was on the same bait. Like, it didn't blow, and I've never come across a bait like that. But what Gary always said to me, Gary Bates, was that what used to happen was a bait would get consistent, which was always usually a version of the squid mix. Then he'd tweak it with tangy, or he'd tweak it with banana, or he'd tweak it with whatever. And it would outfish it for like a season, and then somebody would use the original again, and that would outfish the one that had already outfished the original, because it's just that change, isn't it? It's having a winning formula and making a slight tweak, and the slight tweak can be backdating going to the original one.
My analogy is, I'm getting old now, and I'm very aware that apparently about repeating myself. Yeah, I don't want to think.
Me too. I never mentioned St. Ives.
But my analogy is, we always love fresh bread. Yeah?
Yeah.
But if you was a carp and you always have fresh bread with strawberry jam on it, you get wise to it. So you just change that to my or marmalade or something. Yeah, that's my analogy. Yeah. The fresh bread you always want to eat. But you might, but if you get hooked all the time on strawberry, then that's what you note and that's what you'll stop eating. But you always eat fresh bread. That makes sense.
It does, except as humans, we have got a stop clock? Have we got, like, if you love strawberry cheesecake, at what point do you go, well, that strawberry cheesecake is dangerous? It isn't, because we never get hooked on it. We might get fat, but we don't.
Have you been sick?
It's not danger, is it? Yeah, unless you want to eat it.
If you were sick or waste on strawberry cheesecake, you stop eating
it.
Maybe you eat lemon.
Yeah, I agree with that. If we overeat it to the point of being sick.
And that might not be a bad analogy. Have you ever, for example, had a stomach bug And the thing you ate at that time
is the last thing you eat. Or if you get drunk and throw up on something.
You get drunk on Malibu. First thing you ever get drunk on, you know what I think ever again in your life.
There's some foods I'll never eat again because I was sick on it. Yeah, got sick.
Yeah. Like I said, the drunk one's the best one. If you throw up on cider, people, I know many people, including myself, that can't drink cider for life because they got threw up on it when they were 15 or 16 or something. That's a really good one.
I find it so interesting.
So if you get caught on Scorpic squid, do you all need the banana? Because the core reason why they like the Scorpic squid was the goodness, the S-mix,
it's the bread.
It's the base,
Yeah, that's the bread. But they identify with the...
That's right.
With the taste, with the spread. So just change the taste slightly and they're going to fall for it again. I like that. That's the best. We have discussed this before, but that's the best Analdia thing we've got. And then always eat bread.
When I first joined the BCSG, I got the mags and I got the Fred Wilton original article about the PYM baits, and we started baiting this park lake called Lake Meadows in Bidarecki, and gone on there, and then these other two BCSG members turned up, and because I'd been on there, I just knew their catches didn't make sense. You know, they was catching as much as us, and I went along to the next BCSG meeting, and Derek Stripton, the RO, I said these certain two individuals are also in the BCSG, but they never come to meetings. I said, they've got to be on our bait, Derek. You know, I said, and they're capitalised on it. And he said to me, you need a label. I went, what? He said, get your own label. And I went, what do you mean, Derek? You know, because, bless him, So he was a teacher for some, he was the one who got me in the BCSG.
Yeah.
Against all the odds. I was the youngest member to join. But for some reason he took a shine for me. And, you know, he's one of Fred Wilton's disciples. You know, so he gave me a lot of help. I said, what do you mean? He said, you need a flavour. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, go in the supermarket and find one of the flavours, like vanilla. And like that blew my mind. You know, and that was my introduction to labels and flavours. So we then went in, flavoured it, and we had our own original bait that, you know, these two other guys and no one else could get onto. You know, this goes right back to everything we're talking about tonight, about making the bait your own.
Yeah. In all them days of experimenting as a kid, when it was literally Richworth was the only bait you could buy, and then later came the Rod Hutchinson flavours and stuff you used to find in the local tackle shop. But
Rod was before Richworth.
Was it? But my mum always had vanilla essence in the cupboard, because like pretty much every family baked stuff in those days, cakes and whatever. I never found, I put vanilla essence in everything, I never found it to work as a flavour. Was it me? I tried it in everything. Like, it was never something that actually worked for me. Even though it was like the most common core ingredient at the time, it never worked.
Yeah, you missed the conversation. Mr. Crossing went to the toilet, but I was talking to Roger about when I got my POIM baits, and we thought another couple of BCSC members had got in on it. This lake was on, and I went to a meeting and Derek Stripton was there, he was the RO, and he was in the Fred Wilton crew, and bless him, he really had a soft spot for me, and I told him I just felt that these other two BCSG members were on the same bait as us, as Fred Wilton had published in the BCSG magazine, and he said, you need a label. I went, what? What's a label? Yeah, he said, you need to make it your own, with your own flavour. And I didn't understand what he was saying. And he then said, go to the supermarket and, you know, look at the proprietary flavours like vanilla. But it's in the book, actually, Demon Eye. A health shop opened in Rayleigh, and I walked in there and had this shelf of these dark bottles of Lane's flavourings. I'd never seen before. Strawberry, chocolate, cherry, and that's what we banged into, and that's what gave us a massive massive veg then. And that's what started me on that route to, you know, attractors and flavours.
Pretty much everything from the carp industry has come from like another industry, like you said, the palatants were like to induce
logical industry.
Yeah, it was to induce, you know, young babies to feed and stuff, weren't they? Is there any avenue we've not been down yet? I mean, you got something new with the crayfish meal in the new Key Cray, because that's like a freshwater fish meal, almost. Like it's crayfish are what do they call it, a crustacean, aren't they? They're like, they've got a shell, they're like hard, so they're like pretty much the only freshwater crustacean there is, and you've obviously found a source for crustacean meal, which we know fish meal's been the ace for years. You know, there's people that had shrimp meal, salmon meal, you know, it's like, is there anything that's not been delved down, do you reckon? Is there something else out there that we're not gonna, that we haven't found yet?
Well, I can't say there is, because I haven't found it yet, James.
But constant, something new will come.
I absolutely am, because, you know, this crayfish has come out of nowhere. You know, it is quite an interesting story. We got hold of a company that are farming them.
We haven't told the crayfish story on the podcast.
And to be honest, it is something that I am really interested to hear.
Well,
you know,
I think this is through Keith.
Keith Sykes,
you know, we've become aware that a company were cropping crayfish and turning them into meal. You know, key point here, if it's fish meal or whatever, it's just, you know, the crap bits is sea, but it's also the crap bits that the humans don't want to eat. Whereas in the case of crayfish, and trust me, an English crayfish, the tails are awesome to eat. That's langoustine.
I don't eat them. The nasty looking creature. I don't eat anything that looks that nasty.
We've had that this week with the Chinese, haven't we?
Even the crayfish we get in our lakes in England is as good as any prawn you'll eat.
Yeah.
Anyway, this company are cropping the whole cray and turning them into a meal.
Like a fish meal, like we would buy shrimp meal or salmon meal.
No, because not like a fish meal, because that's all the shit bits. You know, the prime fillets of meat, fish, have gone into the human food.
They're sold off, yeah.
Like I said, there's prime cuts of meat in these crayfish, like the tails, that are as good as any prawn you ever eat. But they're just processing the whole lot into a meal. And we got to hear this and got hold of some, and immediately Gary's contacting me, because we have a various process of trying to understand fish reaction to a bait. And just interesting enough, like the squid, this is the first one since the squid that's got my antenna up. So,
and straight away you've gone, there's something different about this.
There's something special about this, yeah. So we started, we got hold of some, we started putting with baits, and the results are pretty damn good. Then I decided to cut it with a key, because I could compare it against key on one rod, key cray, and it was, oh my God. Yeah, and I said to Alan Blair,
oh my God, as in the Key Cray was out fishing the Key.
Yes, I said to Alan Blair, I've never seen a result like this since I was originally on the squid, Scopet squid, in the early 90s, i.e. as soon as I put that out on a fish, I caught it. Yeah, and that's the point of bait, isn't it? Yeah, you can blank on it, because you weren't on the fish, you know. But if you put it on a fish that's got a need, desire to feed, then you'll get reaction. And with that squid scopex, I've never seen a reaction like that. And I was getting the same with the Key Cray. So we then put that out in various versions, and we started getting feedback from anglers. And where we are now, I would say Yeah, bearing in mind, I believe the best ingredient cardboard has ever seen is the squid extract, and so the best proprietary bait made from that is the Scopex squid. This is at least as good, it's possibly better. For example, Roger Smith and Kerry popped in a couple of weeks ago.
Famous for the leads, them guys.
Well, yeah, Roger Smith is, you know, legend, but you know, probably 99% of your readers, your listeners, have never heard of him. But you know, Roger was the was the angler who called Sally twice. And
anglers of my sort of age will know what exactly.
There's maybe more recent anglers. Even Terry Hearn's written about Smith and Kerry Leads back in the day. Like they were the anglers he looked up to.
Yeah, Roger and Kerry were massive in those days of Hutchie at Savvy. In fact, just going off track here, first time I met Roger, I was over Silver End, I think it was 1981, I was, start of the season, and these two guys pitched up as I turned up at start of the season. One was Roger Smith, the other guy, I can't think of his name, Baker. Can't think, but he was a rod builder down to dying of alcoholic poisoning. But
dying of alcoholic poisoning.
Anyway, had a lovely week with Roger and that, and he was the one that introduced me to alcohol and the fact that you pulled off the lake at lunchtime and had a pint.
not ethanol in baits.
But Roger had a roll-up holder that his dad had made him, right? And in this roll-up holder were three squares to fit the wheels in. The first rod holder was made up rods.
Yeah.
And
heads happy hooker.
The point is, with my girlfriend, who had taught me how to sew, we tried to make that hole, but we couldn't because it was too much material to try and push through the thread of the sewing machine. But then I adapted that to a holder that you split in the middle with zip, and that was the Happy Hooker holder, which arguably is the most successful product I ever made. Because I've always said, every carp brand in the world with a range of luggage had a copy of that holder. So, but anyway, Roger's my, my legend, my icon, blah blah. And he came a couple of weeks ago, and he said to me that they had fed it in his pond at home. And he said to me, his carp, they're very whatever about taking baits. Some days they will, some days they won't. He said they ravished it. And I took a guy on who contacted me about 2 months ago onto our Key Cray field testing team, to get the results for when we launch it. And he sent me a mad email. He said, I don't believe this, Kevin. He said, I have got red-bellied piranha. And he said, they only take live food. They will not eat any of the proprietary piranha foods. He said, I put it in the tank. And he said, I thought they was going to kill each other to get to it. And
to the boilies, and they won't eat any fake thing other than and live food.
I've got another friend, he's a barbel angler, so I gave him some. He went up the Trent, and first time up there, his mate was fishing just downriver from him. He blanked, he had three doubles. Yeah, it seems anything wants to eat it. And it kind of struck me, he was talking about Harefield, tutti frutti's, the bottom used to glow orange. And then the fish meals come out, completely killed that kind of food source. Yeah. Let's go on a few years. The difference krill made, although krill is not used how we'd like to because it's so expensive, so it's just substituted. But that was all marine sources of fish lice. Yeah? This is the first freshwater source of food that has been cropped. And ever. I think ever, other than a few snails in a tin, but they were from China or whatever. And that may be why the feeding reaction is so big. But we're on to an absolute winner here. It's been a journey. Imagine how I felt when we found this bait that is the next thing to squid, and then we're told that introducing cray. crayfish to the water system is illegal. What?
So you found like a wonder bait and then you can't use it?
No. So we've had to go through massive loops and curves with, you know, the authorities, CFAS, whoever it is, I don't know, you know, I didn't get involved in
that.
Yeah, to get certification to be able to use it.
But how's that come about? How have they allowed you to use crayfish?
Because Keith Sykes went through the process with them and got the documentation, and now, and from the supplier, we've got the exclusivity as well.
So like any bait in the UK that's advertised crayfish, it can't actually be crayfish, it must be like a flavour, or
as you say, you know, everyone's going to jump on it now, or they will in the next 12 months, but yeah, they haven't got it because, you know, we got exclusivity to it, and they wouldn't have gone through that process with definitely
getting legal certificates. Yeah, and all, yeah. All I know, I've been using it a few weeks, and all I know that is literally everything likes it. I've caught many carp. I've only been fishing a few times since I've used it. I've caught every time, but it's almost a nuisance bait because every single fish in the lake eats it. To the point of the cultured hook baits, which I think are the single biggest edge I've used in the last 2 years in my entire fishing career. There's something about those cultured hook baits, the wafter pop up inside and then like a coating around the outside, like a paste, but that breaks off over time. I think that's like a huge edge. I use like lightly balanced baits anyway. I've always thought that was good. But what I've found is using cultured hook baits on lakes that have lots of other nuisance fish, like they just eat at it, they peck at the bait, like they're almost too good on. So any lake that's got nuisance fish in, like your bobbins are just like bip, 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 like literally all night long from all over.
To be honest,
and the key cray is like that. It's like everything loves it.
Be honest, you know, the data, that is my concern. Yeah.
That it's too good.
Yeah, the fact is, probably the most effective take runs bait NASA got is TG Active. Yeah, and when I brought Key out, I used to say to people, yeah, I put it on Facebook so many times, yeah, if you want runs, use TG Active. If you want to sit out, catch the biggest. Yeah, I put all that, didn't I? Yeah, but, yeah, and yeah, so my concern was exactly what you're saying, but
I
haven't got a picture, Jamie, because I'm getting so many results back that it's catching the biggest quickly. So
it's hard to say, nobody's getting back to you saying, I think my lake's only got carp and no roach in it, or you get a lake that's got tons of small carp in it and some big ones.
I think my view would be, if you're a class angler and you've got a location spot on, you put Key Cray where that biggest fish is, you're going to catch it in a minute. If you just chuck Key Cray out everywhere else, you're going to catch a stack of fish more than anyone else, but you might have to wade through to get the big one because you haven't got the location right. I think that's the best way I can sum it up.
I've always said the sign of a good bait is that everything likes it. You know, I've had a couple of baits over the years where that's been true, where nuisance fish will it down. I remember years ago, Activate, which I still think is, you know, a close equivalent to some of the best baits ever made, to the Grange, to the Scobet Squid, like everything liked it, but you got pestered with bream, you got pestered with nuisance baits. But I see that as a positive. If fish can't resist the bait, like, yeah, you're going to catch the odd 3 pound roach, you're going to catch bream, like that's the price you have to pay to know that when them carp come over your spot, you're going to catch it. And like, I see that as a positive, not a negative.
It's definitely a positive. I mean,
it's like a rig, and I'm sure
100%. If you nail everything
on a rig, you know you've got a good rig.
I mean, you get pictures of anglers. Daily, you get anglers that I've got pictures of boilies with snails on.
Yeah,
you know, so it's like it's not a negative, the fact that the small fish,
all the snails,
stations, or even the snails are attracted to it. You know,
that's a sign of a good bait, I think, that everything loves it. Yeah. Like that's kind of like, if you've got the most attractive attractor on the planet, everything's going to like it. That goes. There's no way you're going to find an attractor that's only attractive to carp and not to any other fish. It's impossible. But that goes with that is that you get a bit of nuisance fish action, but that to me is a gain, because if you're creating a feeding situation, you're creating an area where all fish are interested in your spot. I think that's a good thing, because when the carp move in, as the king carp, as the biggest species, they're going to push other fish out anyway, because they're the bullies, they're the biggest fish. So yeah, you might catch bream and nuisance fish along the way, but as soon as the carp move in, you're going to catch them.
Yeah,
and that's the sign of a good bait to me. It always has been, and I've heard people say, "Oh, that's a bream bait." Since somebody says to me that's a bream bait, I'm like, "I want to be on that bait, because
it's a fish bait.
It's a fish bait." Yeah, if everything likes it, when the carp come in, you're going to catch them. I'll put it on now.
Yeah.
Never ever found, like, oh yeah, great, I've done it on that lake, I've done it on that lake, I've done it on that lake, and so this lake's going to be easy. No, it's a completely new set of problems.
Isn't that the wonderful thing of carp is, you know, I've always said the lake is like a jigsaw. Yeah, you put all the pieces in.
That's his saying. Jigsaw is his saying.
Yeah.
Is it really?
Yeah.
It's always been mine. Yeah. And, yeah. The modern carp world don't accept a blank as a learning curve. Yeah, yeah. Every session, you could almost argue the blanks are more important.
Step closer.
Are more important than the times you have result, because if you analyse that blank, you're going to learn more from that and put more pieces in the jigsaw until the final piece goes in, bang, zzzz. Yeah, yeah. And that. I think that's the true essence of carp fishing. Yeah, you walk on a lake the first time, and I always said, yeah, even me, when I walk on a lake for the first time, I'm shit scared, I'm nervous. The thing that is most important to me is to get that first take. Until I get that first take, I'm like the most naive bike beginner. Until I've got that first take, I don't believe I can catch them. Once I've got that first take, that gives me the confidence to believe, yes, I can catch
them. I can do it.
I can do it. And then it's about building up all the blocks and all the pieces, put the piece of the jigsaw in place to get the knowledge of the lake until you know it. Yeah, and then, yeah, from my point of view, I'm seeking two things. Either to, hope it doesn't sound arrogant, to be top rod, yeah, and catch the most, as well as catch my target fish. Those are my two achievements.
Yeah, I've always said the same thing, and you know, you said to me about jigsaw, every lake's working out, but every time I work a lake out, I think, right, it's going to solve the next lake.
No way.
But it never does. There's no two lakes.
What I said about the pit, isn't it, and how that humbled me with, you know, all the articles I've written, you know, people using short rigs and tight baits to the hook, bollocks, you know, that humbled me, and it taught me that there is no rules, you know, in carp fishing. You know, every lake is different, and you have to have a completely open mind.
There are no rules, but there are rules that you don't know, because I strongly believe that every lake does what it does for a reason, but you don't know it yet because you've just started on that lake. So, like, there kind of are no rules, except there are rules you don't know.
There's kind of are no rules, but there are rules.
Yeah.
But then again, it's down to you to
work,
to be able to
find
to,
it,
to recognise, you know, what's, you know, the rules are there at that time.
There are, but like,
probably the only clear rule that I've adopted in my life is to be different for everyone else.
I agree that, and I've interviewed a lot of good carp anglers in the last 2 years we've done this podcast. A lot of people who've achieved great things, you know, in carp fishing, from yourself to the Mike Wilmots to the Lee Jacksons to the Chilis. People have always achieved. There's one thing they've got in common, and the one thing they've got in common is they do, it's like there are no rules. They do what they think is right for that particular situation, and that might be different from your situation on a different lake, because as we've just agreed, there aren't many similar situations, but they're all logical. Once you know them, you could tell that jigsaw puzzle to somebody else who could probably solve that jigsaw puzzle on that lake by what you've just told them from what you've learned. So there are patterns, but then patterns are different everywhere you go, and nobody's wrong.
I'm just thinking about what you're saying, Jamie, and I'm just thinking Harefield. Mm. Right? I was an Essex kid. I was brought up on small lakes, you know, up close and personal. You know, and I would still say that's been my biggest edge in my carp fishing career, because the smallest waters are the hardest. And then I went to Harefield, you know, this massive lake in terms of Essex waters. You know, these anglers are all, you know, got these awesome rods, you know, they're casting massive distances, and I was a margin angler. And what happened there, I was entirely out of my comfort zone, so I tried to follow them, and that wasn't anything I knew, you know, had no expertise of, and you know, so that first weekend I blanked, and to be honest, I didn't want to go back. I forced myself to go back the second weekend, but you know, there's 3 bars at Harefield, you know, and there's all fishing. The second bar, blah blah, the third bar was absolutely real extreme, you know, it was just about a lucky day some of them might have reached it. But the second time I went back, I saw a fish roll only 20 yards out, and so I fished short on the inside bar, and I got a take. I arrived on the Friday, got a take on Sunday morning. I lost it, but the point I'm making is I got a take.
Gave you the confidence.
It gave me the confidence that I could catch them. Yeah.
And
that changed everything for me. If I had blanked that weekend, honestly, sitting here,
you might not have gone back.
Because I would have felt scared and out of my depth.
Listen to the Carpcast on iTunes and subscribe through the podcast app on your iPhone or iPad. For Android users, find us on the Stitcher Radio app. Go to Google Play and download Stitcher Radio for podcasts. Add us to your playlist and click listen to hear us anytime you like. Don't forget to enable offline listening if you wish to save your data on the bank. We're also available on the SoundCloud app under The Carpcast, or check our website at www.thecarpcast.com. Remember, listening through an app will recall where you were up to when you get that screamer, or you could always make a whip. The fish, of course.
So that's where we have to cut the interview off. Started getting very loud and leery after that. Hope it wasn't too painful. You could hear Ridge and Kevin's dog snoring through the last sort of 15 minutes of that. So I apologise. It wasn't me falling asleep on the table. I did that a bit later on, just before I threw up in Kevin's garden. So, yeah, many apologies to Kevin. I know we'll be listening to this, and then we'll try and get another interview with Roger at some point, and I'll encourage him a bit more when we're not so drunk, and get him chatting a little bit more, because he's got so much that he can tell us. But that's it. Until Mark's back, hopefully next week, then that's all. We'll speak soon.